Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show.
I missed you.
Great to be back. I'm Zach Birchie, and the Super Nerds are reassembling for another episode this year, which I'm really happy to have all y'all back on. Justin Savakis is here.
Yep. Hey.
Returning after a little time off. And also, of course, contributor to Anime News Network, it's Mike Toole.
Hey, everybody.
And, of course, again, Otaku USA contributor and host of the ever-popular Anime World Order podcast, it's Daryl Surratt.
Hey, folks. Nice to be on again.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you all back here. It's been a little while, and lots to talk about. It's been a busy summertime season, busy convention season. We're on the other side of con season now, which I'm extremely grateful for.
Oh, thank God.
And we, yeah. We'll get to that in a little bit, but I guess we'll just start off with what we've kind of been watching lately. I've watched some stuff. I know y'all have watched plenty of stuff, so let's just go ahead and get into that. Justin, what have you watched lately?
Well, I now that it was all over, I marathoned Kids on the Slope.
How'd it turn out?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah, I mean, I like it, and it does some very noteworthy things, especially with the animation and as far as musical stuff. But I was expecting it to be. I didn't even need it to be epic making. I just needed it to be memorable, and it really kind of wasn't.
I haven't finished it. Is it at least emotionally satisfying?
Sure, to a point. I mean, it's, you know, yet another Japanese youth borderline homoerotic buddy drama.
Okay.
That's what they do over there, and they're damn good at it. And this is a decent example of it, but it doesn't really rise beyond that. And, you know, it stays very ambiguous, and it is smart in how it portrays its teenage characters. It is a little more realistic than most, but it doesn't go anywhere spectacular, and it's not particularly groundbreaking or brilliant. It's just kind of good. I guess that just speaks to how high expectations were for this show. It's just kind of good, and that's a disappointment.
It sounds like maybe it's just a nice little show.
Right, basically. A nice little show with some spectacular musical numbers.
Anybody else watch that?
Yes. Yeah, I've seen the whole thing, and Mr. Maruyama from MAPPA, the studio that produced it, a former Madhouse guy, spoke about it pretty extensively in his panel at Otakon, and he did point out that they spent an awful lot of the budget on the musical sequences, and you can certainly see that in the animation. They are pretty spectacular. From a story point of view, Justin, I disagree. I was satisfied with it. For me, the Kids in the Slope was a slice of life story in the actual correct, you know, sense, in the James Joyce sense, in that it wasn't about a story with a specific beginning, middle, and end. It was just about kind of a point in time. And for me, that worked.
Huh.
I respect the fact that it didn't really fall into a lot of the same traps that a lot of those shows that Justin describes fall into. This is not a show where it's 13 episodes for the guy to freaking tell the girl, hey, I like you. That it's not doing that sort of thing. And for that alone, I can respect it. But I do see where Justin is coming from in that maybe the idea of Kids in the Slope is a little better than the execution in some ways. But it's still, you know, if you try to look at it based on its core elements, it's like, yeah, that's a cut above the par. Animation, music, great soundtrack, you know, story, yeah, fairly smart characterization, nobody is particularly annoying, so it's more, maybe the sum is slightly less than its parts.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, to be fair, my expectations were based not on Watanabe's works that everyone knows, you know, the Bebops and the Champloos, but my expectation was based on his short Ingenious Party, Baby Blue, which is possibly one of my favorite pieces of animation ever made. And knowing that he's capable of that breadth of human emotion and seeing him not go there, maybe this is just an example of your bringing preconceived notions to a party. I can't help but feel let down.
Well, it
wasn't. You just reminded me that there's no U.S. release of Genius Party, and so most people watching Kids on the Slope would have no idea what that is.
Yeah, that's disappointing for three of the shorts in Genius Party.
Well, isn't this also based on a manga that's not finished?
I believe they said at Otakon that there was it did finish, and that the lead voice actor said she didn't want to read the final volume because then it'd be over. But I have not read any of the manga myself.
Well, so it's not his original story. So
no, it's the first time he's doing someone else's stuff.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe
and according to the panel, he did struggle a little with that.
I mean, that's a guy where I want to see his ideas. I don't really want to see him doing other people's ideas. That's like when they announce, like, oh, hey, they're considering Paul Thomas Anderson for the next Batman movie. I'm like, please don't waste his time with that. Please do not waste his time with Batman. I want to see his ideas.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, one of the biggest tragedies that I discovered going to Maruyama's panel at Otakon was, in fact, that he had three years where he was working on original projects, and they all went into turnaround.
Oh,
God. All of them. So that's including a feature.
Do people listening know what went into turnaround means?
Your good point. It means that they got shit canned before they started production.
I believe the term that is more commonly used would be development hell.
Right.
Yeah. They're not really dead, but they're in this twilight zone where they're never really going to get made.
Right.
Yeah. Like almost every live action anime project.
Right.
That's basically what happens to them. But, yeah, well, okay. Well, that's a little bit of a shame, but, you know, if it's a nice little show, then, you know.
Yeah, I understand your perspective, Justin, and I agree that if you're expecting the show to wrap up in a neat little package, it doesn't do that. But for me, it still worked, and I definitely want more anime like it.
Well, anyone who knows my taste knows that was not what I was looking for. I was just hoping for a nice little emotional punch in the gut I never got.
All right, well, Kids on the Slope.
Yeah, you're right. The show never goes there, and yeah, it almost does a couple of times.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, moving on.
Anything else?
Oh, as far as stuff I watched?
Yeah.
Let's see. I finally, you know, I've had this Apple TV and this iPad for a while, and I knew that you could watch Crunchyroll through your Apple TV, and I'd played around with it. I'm like, this is pretty awesome, but I didn't really have time to sit down and really watch anything.
Yeah.
And now that I have time, I was just like, this is fantastic. So I've actually been watching a few simulcasts. I watched, I am snake bit today with audio.
Yeah.
I watched, the first few episodes anyway of, Natsuyuki Rendezvous.
I've heard nothing but good things about that.
It started off very strong and now it's kind of losing me.
Really?
Yeah, it's Jose, so that means the characters actually are and act like adults, which is a nice change of pace. And it's, you know, Noitani Musho, which means it's aimed at smarter audiences. But it's also, kind of this very slow build love story between a guy that works at a flower shop and his boss. But getting in the way is the ghost of her dead husband, and that only he can see. And it's kind of a simple, kind of cliched setup, but it works effectively for a while, until about episode 4 or 5, where you start realizing, gee, this guy that I'm supposed to be rooting for his romance, he's not very interesting. In fact, he's kind of lame.
Mm-hmm. That's sort of the typical anime romance male lead, if you think about it.
I feel like he's a little bit more assertive than that. Natsuyuki Rendezvous is one of two simulcasts that I'm really bothering with this season, and I haven't seen the last two episodes, but I've enjoyed it greatly so far. I think it's funny, it's interesting, and it has this mean streak to it that I really like.
Right? Yeah, I did respond to that. Like, the ghost is kind of a dick.
Yeah, and the living guy is a dick right back.
Right. like they can't stand each other and make no bones about making that known. Mm-hmm. But it's it can still turn around for me. I'll keep watching it. The other show that I'm finally getting around to watching is Princess Jellyfish.
Oh, finally.
Huh. Finally, yeah. I'm very, very behind on everything.
That's another one where the manga is still ongoing, I believe.
Is it?
Yeah, the conclusion is... it kind of wraps up neatly, but... I don't know. I really like Princess Jellyfish. What did you think?
I'm about halfway through it. I'm really digging it so far. Obviously I'm not quite as sympathetic towards characters that are kind of trapped in their own low self-esteem because...
Because you can't help but be judgmental even...
Yeah, because I'm a gigantic dick. That's actually exactly why. It makes me rethink that point of view a little bit, and it is compelling, even if some of the characters are a little on the annoying side.
Yeah, I feel like that show captured truly annoying people where you know that they're just broken and it's not really their fault, but they're right. So irritating. And we had people like that in like my anime club where we would tolerate them and they would hang around, like the girl who's obsessed with Romance of the Three Kingdoms.
I like that.
God.
Like, I know people that were like that, and they're really frustrating and obnoxious to be around, but I guess, I don't know, I would still tolerate them because, hey, we're all nerds, we're all kind of broken.
The classic geek social fallacy. Yes, but yeah, I think that was the reality of the show, is that, hey, you know someone who's really into something strangely esoteric that no one else really around them is that into, but, you know, you can sort of respect their mania.
And you're just trying to be nice because you know it's not their fault, like... Something else is wrong. That's why they're like this. But it captured that, hey, wouldn't it be obnoxious to be around someone like this? Like, yeah, it is. It's really annoying. But you can't help but feel sympathetic. And that show has more than one character like that, I think.
Yeah, it does. And I also have to underline, I think you and Bamboo mentioned this before, that has possibly the worst opening in anime history.
Whoa. Are you talking about the opening credits?
Opening theme song.
It gets in your head.
I like it.
Really?
It's good.
It does this weird thing with 3/4 time signature. It doesn't work, and the vocalist is shrill. It just drives me up the wall.
If I'm thinking of the same song.
No, that song seemed like it was pretty all right, and it went well with the, obviously much more memorable animation for the opening credits.
No, the animation's pretty cool, and the I guess it captures the mood of the show fairly well. It's just, I don't know, it's just nails on chalkboard for me, and I don't know why.
I really liked the fact that they played a little bit on Sex and the City in the opening, because if there's anything that's sort of the same show but the opposite... It's kind of Princess Jellyfish in terms of a show about friendship among women. I don't know.
That show went in one ear and out the other for me. I got through the first two episodes. It didn't make much of an impression, and I just never went back.
Yeah, I talked about it at length on an episode on this of the show, and I still have fond memories of it. I don't think I'll ever watch it again, but yeah. Pretty good.
Yeah, I'm very happy that's up on YouTube because I don't picture myself buying the DVD of this.
Yeah, although the DVD, for people who are interested, the DVDs are loaded. Like, there's a ton of stuff on there. And it's on Blu-ray, which is going to become increasingly uncommon for us. If you like the show, buy it because there's a lot of extra material on there.
I've noticed that it seems to speak much more personally to the geek girls in my life than a lot of the guys who mostly tend to say, yeah, it's pretty good, but, you know, I wouldn't go back to it.
That's what
you talked about last time, so we won't revisit that whole thing.
It is for women. The show is for women. It's for a female audience.
Lives up to the Jose handle.
Yeah. Okay, so Princess Jellyfish, anything else, or does that end your spree?
I'm sure I watched something else, but that's enough for me.
All right. Mike, what about you?
Well, like I said, I'm watching two new shows this season. One of them is Natsuyuke Rendezvous. The other one is Humanity is Declining. Mm. That's kind of hot and cold. For the most part, I'm enjoying it. I've said in other venues that it's like this. It's cute, but it's got this weird, you know, kind of viciously dark undertone to it. It's like it's Cormac McCarthy's Tiny Snow Fairy Sugar.
Mm. It's
not Bottle Fairies, Mike.
Oh well, it's Jose Saramago's Bottle Fairies. You know, take your acclaimed author who writes end of the world dystopian fiction and make it cutesy and weird.
It's deeply cynical about everything. Like, yes. I'm a cynic, and that show is a little much.
Yeah, there are a couple of points in, I think it's episode 3 or 4, that were serious whoa moments. But it's keeping me interested. The aesthetic of it is weird. It's visually, it's not the kind of show I usually go for, but I'm enjoying it, and it's keeping me engaged. And I have to say, you know, most of the stuff that's new for the summer is not. I don't know about you guys, but yeah, just this season I'm not really feeling. I've tried that Total Eclipse thing. It's this horrible, you know, based on an erogay, you know, hentai game deal. It's got it's got some ultra violence and it's got some mecha stuff, but ultimately it's just not that good. Let's see what else. I'm continuing on with Polar Bear Cafe, Space Brothers, which I think is the best anime series running on Japanese TV at the moment, and Hunter x Hunter.
Yeah,
you know, Space Brothers. I'm probably going to dig into that after I finish up Princess Jellyfish.
Well, you also have a second season of Moyashimon.
You know, that was the other one I started to watch, and I had to bail on it because it just sucks.
Didn't they sort of make
it? Did you like the first season?
I loved the first season passionately. I'm still disappointed that it never came out on Blu-ray here because I would have snapped that shit up. But this second season is not good. The animation's crappier. The character designs are simpler. The characters don't really seem to do anything interesting. There's no humor at all. It's just kind of meh.
My impression of that is that, at least the commentary I saw on it was, we took this show that was special and different and sort of quirky and made it fall in line with a lot of other mass-produced anime.
Well, it's a completely different staff, and it's clearly not as good of a staff. So I think it's just testament to the people that were making the original show that this B team just couldn't hack it.
Oh man, yeah, switching staff like that is very dangerous. I can't really think of an example where that's worked out.
Huh.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, continuing on with Space Brothers, it's one of those shows where you want to talk about cynical. It's the opposite. It's got this air of hopefulness and optimism, and the characters are just great. They're fleshed out. They're sympathetic. The main character, Muta, I think he's awesome. He's a character who, on the outside, he's confident and he does just enough to get stuff done. And on the inside, the show is really driven by his internal monologue where, you know, he's constantly nervous and on edge and terrified of screwing stuff up. And it's just so enjoyable. And it's about the space program, and there's lots of really good space nerd stuff going on in there.
Yeah, isn't that open ended, or have they actually announced an episode count for it?
I honestly don't know. I know that the manga is very popular, and that they in May had a live action film that was in Japanese theaters that I've heard pretty bad things about. But I know that it's a popular property. I was assuming that since it just seems to be plowing on and on, it's probably going to go to like 50 episodes.
I think it's scheduled for at least that.
Yeah.
But.
But it's one of the highlights of my week. It's friends of mine who read the manga complain about the pacing of it. They feel like it's taken way too long on stuff, but I've enjoyed it immensely so far.
That's cool. Yeah, I think I might.
Well, you should always watch the movie or watch the show before you go back and read the book, because when you go in knowing that sort of stuff, it kind of, you know, you can't really judge what you're watching, you know, fairly.
Right.
My biggest question about that is, when is it going to get snapped up and adapted for American audiences by Tom Hanks? Like, that's got to happen, right?
I've been wondering that myself, because the concept of brothers, you know, competing and going into space together in that way, that seems ripe for a Hollywood adaptation. I could see it happening, and I could see it working too.
Yeah, it's a pretty good idea for a story. okay, so I wanted to ask. Did you have more on that?
A few more. I got the manga UK release of Welcome to the Space Show, so I could experience that again. It's still a failure. It's a very interesting failure, and the first two thirds of the movie are visually just great. It's just so enjoyable to watch, and it's amazing how it just kind of in slow motion just completely goes off the rails in the last act.
Isn't that 2.5 hours long?
Yeah, it really feels like it's a movie made by people who don't know how to make movies. Like, their experience is TV, and they're still trying to pace things for a TV 13-episode thing, and then they just sort of squash it down to try and make things fit, because I really... There's at least a good, you know, 30 or so minutes of that movie that really doesn't need to be there.
Yeah.
And it ends, and you think, like, it's over, and then it still keeps going.
There are, like, two false endings, Daryl. Yeah, and it's about 2 hours and 20 minutes long. And
it's a kid's movie.
You can't have a kid's movie that's 2 hours and 20 minutes long. And has a couple of these weird, confusing subplots involving the alien characters. It's, you know, it's one of those things that it looks great, and I'm happy to have seen it again, and it's got a really nice English dub, but I think there's a reason why it just hasn't gotten picked up for this region. It's a hard sell. I've seen that, and also I got a huge load of Discotech stuff. So the other day I watched Demon City Shinjuku and the Space nice. Adventure Cobra movie.
Double nice.
Sweet.
Yeah. Well, what was that noise, Justin? Was that appreciated?
Justin has...
Yeah, that was a rubbing my belly moment.
Okay, I thought it was triggered like a Vietnam-style flashback for Demon City Shinjuku. Like, I don't know if you have some sort of bad...
I like Demon City Shinjuku.
I love Demon City Shinjuku.
It has, even though it doesn't add up to much, it has some of the greatest visceral moments in anime history.
Yeah, it opens with Ed Chavez from Vertical in a sword fight.
Yeah, guy does look like him. But yeah, it's all earthquakes and sword fights and absurd stereotypical characters, and it's Yoshiaki Kawajiri, so everything is blue and very starkly illuminated. And Space Adventure Cobra is just one of those things where I popped the movie and just to have a quick look at it and had to watch the whole thing.
Yeah, it's very pretty, that movie.
It operates on that level, and the DVD is very nice. I'm happy Discotech released it. So that's the anime I've been watching.
Excellent. I did want to ask about Hunter x Hunter. How's that going?
Hunter Hunter is up and down. It's a very kind of passive thing where I have it on and I don't even necessarily have to pay attention to every moment of it. It's very by the numbers shown in tournament, but the characters and settings are kind of interesting. It's, you know, it's modern world kind of stuff, but not our modern world. There's all kinds of weird exotic twists going on. And, you know, I don't know. I got on board at the beginning of it. I never watched the original version, and it's just something that I've just had every week. And it's like comfort food. It doesn't wow me, but it's enjoyable.
Nice. All right. Well, I'm happy that that's plugging along. I didn't want it to be a failure.
Well, I just hope that Togashi actually manages to wrap it up. Because I feel like part of why this got rebooted is because he's been making it again. He takes long breaks, and he's been talking about wanting to end it. So hopefully that happens.
I think he's painted himself into a corner and doesn't know how to end it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, the manga I'm not up on either. I know it's infamous because of his long breaks and because it's been going for years and years and years, but I haven't actually been reading it.
Isn't that one of those cases where, like, you can see when he's getting tired? Because the art quality just turns to garbage, and then he takes a huge hiatus. Like, wasn't there a case of fans, like, complaining about the art? I seem to remember that happening. I think that guy has issues.
Well, you know, he's married to Naoko Takeuchi, isn't he? So
between
that and his hits, I think he doesn't ever really need to work ever again if he doesn't want to.
Yeah, yeah. Surprised he hasn't finished it at this point already. But anyway, Daryl, what's up?
Well, for the last couple of weeks, I've been preparing for Otakon, and that required me to watch through basically the history of Lupin the Third, because I was doing a 40-year retrospective, and that entailed me watching the 40 years of Lupin the Third, more or less. So there was that. In addition, I also have my Otaku USA writing deadlines, which I just got in under the wire. And I may as well plug that that's now available digitally. So for people with iPad, Kindle, Android, you can also get that magazine via those methods. But yeah, I was watching stuff for that. And so I didn't really have a whole lot of time to just watch stuff on my own lately, because between panel preparations and then podcasting, where I guess our next Anime World Order podcast review is going to be about the Unico movies, also released by Discotech recently. So I'll plug that. And, you know, the magazine. That's pretty much kept me pretty much occupied as far as sitting down and, you know, watching stuff goes. I'm just trying to think, like, when's the last thing I actually was just watching to watch? I'm drawing a blank.
Well, if you watched 40 Years of Lupin, that dovetails into what I'm going to talk about. So we can get into the Lupin talk.
Sure.
So I watched Lupin the Third, The Woman Named Fujiko Mine, which I had meant to watch the whole thing at some point, but these days I tend to wait till something's over and then watch it all, like, in a chunk.
I'm the same way because I want confirmation that it didn't suck at the end, but in the case of Lupin, I did watch that every week.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if... I don't know if it would have been better or worse. I really liked that show. I think it's a beautiful... kind of a failure. I think it's a little bit of a failure, just in terms of what they were reaching for. It's really ambitious. Like, they're trying... they're trying for something. They're really reaching for the stars. At least that's the... that's the feeling I got from it, just with the insane visual style and the just the sheer amount of nudity in it. And the characterizations are all pretty... Zenigata is totally different.
Having rewatched the first series as well as Dead or Alive, I actually thought that those kind of were the templates of the Zenigata they got from here. But yeah, he's definitely a little more evil. In this series, you do some things. You know, Zenigata in the past was typically always the man of justice, the perfectly straight arrow, the Boy Scout. Correct, Mike. And this time, yeah, he's a lot more cunning, a lot more wily, a lot more willing to bend the rules, a lot more willing to kill.
Yeah,
in his pursuit of Lupin the Third, and that's an interpretation of Zenigata that has differed and varied over the years. But I did like the series. I think. You know, as the guidance counselor poster in high schools everywhere would say, if you shoot for the stars, even if you miss, you end in the treetops. And maybe arguably Fujiko Mine was like that.
Yeah, I think so. I like the
show a lot. I think there's one of those things that depending on what you are expecting the show to do, one of those things is actually impossible, which is to say to establish a definitive origin story for these characters. Can't be done fundamentally. To do so would effectively invalidate a lot of stories or call into question a lot of things. It's kind of like, you know, it's been around for 40 some years, and it would be like trying to do an origin story for Golgo 13, you know, and whenever they do that, there's always some little thing to call into doubt the veracity of the claim because, you know, these characters just are. So for the people who are watching the show saying, oh, we're finally going to see, like, what caused all this to come to be, you can't really get that from the series.
You don't get that. And one thing that, like, I feel like a chunk, maybe a third of the reason that I really liked the show, maybe half, just the character designs. Like, they're fantastic. And they look great when they're being, even though the show's pretty cheaply animated, like, they look great. Like, every time Lupin is on screen, I'm captivated because his character design is so great. And it's sort of a little bit of a more maniacal version of his usual character design. And I did like that in the very final episode, the last shot of him does kind of revert to the typical. There's like a frame where it reverts to his typical look. And it's kind of a nice little contrast. But just the character design, the look of the show is kind of half the reason to watch it. If you like stuff like that, if you're into the red lines of the world, if you're into stuff that doesn't look like anime,
yeah,
really.
Visually, it is frustrating to a point because they are reaching so hard and they just don't have the budget for it.
No, they don't. And there's some really janky looking animation in the show. Like, there are some scenes where they're doing this weird thing where the shading is all these straight black lines on everything. And it sort of creeps in as darkness from the sides of the frame and then it turns into these harsh lines, which is a really interesting technique, but they don't have the money to really pull it off. So often it kind of looks weird.
Yeah, like if they had like the Gonkutsu sort of budget, which I think is kind of what they were sort of going for with some of those shading effects with the way it was layered, it would have turned out a little better. I know a lot of the hardcore key animation fans who really worship Lupin the Third as being like this total animator's playground over the years have noted that, you know, the original older 70s shows seem to be more experimental and innovative in their animation as this new series, and you know, this is a digital production. They've got all sorts of assistants and, you know, what have you. But there's any number of reasons for why that is the case. But I did like the look of the show. There were moments where it definitely looked and animated and moved the way that you would expect of Lupin in the general sense. But yeah, for the most part, it's a lot of stills, a lot of shadows, a lot of, you know, trick photography or cinematography, as it were. I didn't mind it, but I can perfectly understand where everyone's coming from. The reception to this is definitely mixed.
Yeah, and to wit, like, my opinion of the first half of the show is higher than my opinion of the last half. And that is chiefly because of the overarching plot that they attempted to put in.
Are you going to be going into spoilers now?
I will let you know when I'm going to go into spoilers. we should note, Mike hasn't finished the show and doesn't want to be spoiled. So we're gonna alert Mike when we're going to talk about the end of the show, because I do want to talk about this. But yeah, anyway, so that's going to happen. But I do feel like those first six episodes where they're bringing in the characters sort of one by one and they're establishing their relationships together. Personally, my favorite episode was the Goemon episode, where he's on the train and she's cosplaying as Maria from The Sound of Music. great episode. I think that was my favorite one.
My favorite was the Jigen one, but maybe that's just because Jigen's my favorite character.
Well, maybe that has something to do with it. Yeah, no, that was good too, and I liked all of those. All of them were good. Every time they were introducing a new character, not a new character, but someone you were expecting to see on the show... Yeah. I feel like they did that really well, and the writing was all really strong in those episodes, and it was all character work. And I feel like I knew more about these characters, even though that's kind of the trick that the show is playing. I do feel like I had a better understanding of those characters after seeing their individual episodes than I did before. And my experience with Lupin is pretty limited. Like, I've seen a handful of shitty TV specials, some good ones. I saw the Jenny on release of the original show. You know, that's kind of my experience with Lupin. But this time I felt like I knew these characters a little bit better and they had a little bit more depth to them.
Yeah, I think the Jigen one is my favorite of those early ones too. Partly because, you know, the idea of them, of Fujiko and Jigen, you know, working together and shacking up was just kind of hilariously awkward. Because in the main continuity of the story, they never get along very well, and you get the sense they don't like each other that much. So there's this weird subtext going on, but I liked it. It was interesting.
It also becomes a running joke that Jigen has a small penis, which I thought yeah. was funny. Like, that's an interesting twist on that character.
Yeah.
especially because he's, you know, a gunsman and all that stuff. mm-hmm. But no, I thought they were bringing the only character I feel like didn't get any sort of development at all was Lupin.
Well, the series kind of treated him like a force of nature.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. But anyway, I think we're going to talk about the end now and what the show is actually trying to say. So, Mike,
I will recuse myself and send me a chat thing when you get that wrapped up.
We will alert you. Okay. So, all right. I think he's gone. Okay. So, Daryl, you finished the show.
All right. Yeah, I did finish the show.
And I have to admit, my biggest problem here, I really loved what the show was saying at the end. I didn't like the fact that it took up so much real estate in the show itself. I feel like that whole storyline could have been in one episode.
Yeah, I agree. I think that when the show started to actually have serialization in its plot, which is an unheard of thing for a Lupin TV series, there everything is notoriously done in one, kind of makes it seem like, oh, it's going to build up to something particularly grandiose. And in this case... It's nice. I just don't feel like it necessarily had to be that long. But I did like that they let some aspects of it breathe. In a sense, it feels like they were trying to have it a bit of both ways, like have the lengthier time that a movie would allow within the span of a TV show.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I really liked what it was trying to say, which is basically you're never going to know these characters. You're never really going to know them. You're never going to know their backstory. You're not going to know their history. This is the chief cast of Lupin. You accept them for who they are. They're sort of iconic institutions. You're never going to fucking know them. And also, Fujiko, probably the cruelest character.
But I like that. I like that that's great, you know, that sort of mean-spiritedness, because for so long, Lupin has sort of gone the route that I frequently say of, you know, mainstream Marvel DC treatment of their characters, as opposed to how they were originally created in the 60s and 70s. Lupin also is a creation of the 60s and 70s. And at the beginning, they were just doing stuff off the cuff, just screwing around. And then over time, as certain movies or certain runs ended up becoming known as the popular ones, the powers that be, when it came time to make TV specials once a year, decided that is set in stone and it has to happen every time, and because that's the convention and the formula. And this TV series, Fujikomine, has decided to say, you know what? It doesn't have to be this way. Yeah, there's some stuff that is just going to be the way it is and you have to just deal with it. But you don't need to stick this closely to convention and tradition, because the originals didn't. And the way that they ended up conveying that message to the viewer, I think, is very effective, though a lot of people are just pissed over the way this all turned out.
I was, you know, one of the chief reasons that I was kind of okay with it, and this comes into another discussion, but I liked the fact that they, through this whole show, they're setting up the fact that Fujiko's is the way she is because she endured a torturous childhood full of sexual abuse and mind control. And then it turns out,
which is oftentimes, you know, the default, you know, I suffered a horrible trauma when I was, you know, whatever. Now I'm a quote, a scare quotes, strong female character. And you sort of think that they're going to go this route. And they're like, you know what? Screw that.
Well, what I really liked about it was it's like, oh, I use my sexuality as a weapon because I was raped, because this horrible shit happened to me when I was a kid. And what the show is basically saying is, no, she's just kind of a badass who uses sexuality as a weapon.
And I like that.
And that's it. That's great. Like, that is kind of great. Because through the whole show, I was sitting there thinking, is this sexist? Is this show really sexist? And then ultimately, no, I don't think it is. I think that Fujiko's sexuality is her, it's her weapon. That's what she uses. That's, like, everybody else on the Lupin crew has their specialty or whatever, and that's hers. Like, she knows how to use that to get what she wants. I don't think that's a weakness. I don't think it's sexist. I think it's a pretty, like, weirdly enough, like, we talk about strong female characters all the time. This is truly one of them. I think so. Even though she's kind of a bad person and...
Well, the Lupin gang should all be kind of bad people,
yeah,
because
they are
criminals. And, you know, the original conception of it was Lupin would never rob from the rich to give to the poor, because that ain't cool, man.
Yeah.
And over time, it ended up being, hey, these guys are ultimately heroes that are, you know, lovable rogues and doing the right thing. And this one sort of puts the edge back on the cast. And I like that that it is sort of saying that we can still tell interesting stories this way. We don't have to introduce time travel or magical laser genies or have a crossover with Detective Conan, which is another story. That's, you know, it wasn't even a proper crossover, in my opinion. But, you know, they've been for years wondering, what do we do with these characters? We're just so mined for ideas. Well, there's got to be some sort of new, bizarre, unattainable treasure that they have to get, and now they have to have this kind of chase, and no, you don't need to do all that stuff. So, yeah, I like that they're sort of bringing it back to the roots while at the same time throwing away all the quote-unquote unnecessary baggage.
Yeah.
I'm interested to see what will happen next. I mean, obviously, they can't follow this up. At least I don't think they can. They're probably just going to hopefully not just keep on proceeding as normal with the specials as they've been doing for several years. I may sound like I'm being a little too harsh on the specials, but you know, there are some legitimately great ones throughout the years. It's just, you know, it's been 20 some years. You know, you can't bat 1,000.
Yeah, no. I mean, Christ. Fujiko's Unlucky Days.
I actually like Fujiko's Unlucky Days, but I can see why, you know, people are down on it.
But, I mean, the reason that I call this particular TV show a little bit of a failure is it's just because of that. I feel like they came up with one thing that they wanted to do and then kind of had to fill in a lot of space. And yeah, I would have been happy with 12 capers and then one episode of sort of meta commentary on the Lupin characters and whether or not you're ever going to know who they really are or where they came from.
That said, there was some pretty fantastic and surreal imagery throughout those additional episodes that I feel sort of make up for it. That, yeah, it's not really that necessary for plot or character, but, like, talk about cinematography and just crazy wild images.
Yeah, it's overall, like, if you are even remotely interested in the Lupin franchise, if you've never seen any of it, I would say this is an okay place to start. It helps if you're familiar with the characters up front, but this is probably also the most accessible version of the show at this point, so may as well check it out. But I strongly recommend it to anyone with a mild interest in the show.
Yeah, likewise, I loved it.
So I think we can bring Mike back in.
Okay.
All right.
Yay.
You're spoiler free.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
So let's talk about Otakon before we get to Twitter. We got a lot of Twitter questions. But I did not go to Otakon. I'm going to go next year for the 20th anniversary. I will be there. But y'all went. And so, Justin, let's start with you. How was the show?
The show was great. I had a great time what I saw of it. Unfortunately, I threw my back out the day before my flight to Baltimore.
Oh, God. Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah, I barely saw you.
I saw you for like 10 seconds. But I spent all of Friday. I managed to do the three panels that I was required to write up. And the 1ANN panel, and I was just flat on my back in my hotel room. It was really bad. Thank God our friend James was there. He's an acupuncturist and a pretty good one, and he pretty much saved my life because I was actually up and around for the rest of the weekend. But that was rough.
Yeah, James is a really great guy, and he's always willing to do that. He's always, anytime people say something, he's like, I'll help you out right now. And usually I'm like, it's all right, I don't really need it. But it sounded like you really needed it this time.
Oh, my God. There is nothing worse than being at a convention and being unable to stand up straight. That was brutal. But once I got past that, I had a good time. I managed to finally see Mike Stubbs' at Time Forgot panel, which I haven't seen in like 4 or 5 years.
What did you think?
It was great, as always. It was I spend those panels kind of in shock at how low the bar is that you are willing to sit through a show.
Oh, yeah. I'll anything that's in English, it's just, you never know what it's going to be. A lot of it's going to be like unbelievable crap, but some of it's going to be amazing, and oftentimes it's both.
What was the one with the polar bears?
The polar bear cubs. I mean,
the most requested one on the entire Dubs at Time Forgot is this polar bear one.
Holy shit. I literally spent that entire, and you showed a lot of clips of that, and I spent the entire time agog. It's like, if I was watching this alone, I would not have made it 30 seconds. Mike managed to mine this entire movie for clips. And,
it's not Polar Bear Cafe, guys. It's a totally different, unrelated polar bear cartoon.
Just a bit.
It's a TV movie from 1979.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, that was a good time. Hung out with some of the podcast guys. We recorded a little one-off special, and that was fun. And yeah, it was just pleasant. I hadn't been to Otakon in about 4 years, and I had forgotten just kind of what a pleasant, friendly atmosphere it is. And I'd also kind of forgotten East Coast nerds are very different from West Coast nerds, and I had a little bit of culture shock.
Yeah,
I always hear that, but
But I went to a West Coast con for the first time earlier this year, and there was a bit of a culture shock in just how strange the convention itself was, but the people seem pretty consistent.
You know, maybe it's just Anime Expo I'm too used to, because come to think of it, Anime LA feels a little more like Otakon. But the thing with Anime Expo is the kids that come to Anime Expo, you get the feeling that it's like borderline mainstream for them. You know, it's a lot of kids from the suburbs, especially the suburbs with high Asian populations. You get the feeling that, you know, they might be into some nerdy things, but they're more or less normal kids.
You ever go to FanimeCon?
No.
I feel like FanimeCon is probably like the hardcore fan con.
Yeah, probably. Probably. And then I get to Otakon, you know, fresh from AX, being like, okay, well, that's... you know, my current idea of what an anime con is like. And I'm like, oh, right, these guys. Oh, God. Yeah, these are nerds. This is what it's like. And, you know, it was refreshing, but at the same time, it was kind of like, oh, yeah, nerds are not mainstream. Nerds are barely even acceptable to mainstream people. And this is kind of awesome.
Okay. I'm curious. I have not been to an East Coast convention in a long time. And all I hear is how sort of hardcore those audiences are. And being used to the two conventions I go to every single year without fail are AX and San Diego, which are basically kind of mellow in terms of the crowd. Like, and I think it's generally because there's a lot of people in there and there's not really a lot of space for annoying people to stand out.
Well, actually, that's a big change. Otakon is much quieter than it used to be.
Yeah, I was shocked that there wasn't a whole lot of yelling and stuff in the halls like there usually is.
Yeah, occasionally someone would try to start something and people would just kind of roll their eyes.
Which, I think I put that out on Twitter. It was like, I think these people are all horrible liars that Otakon isn't this noisy mess.
And, it's not anymore. It's like that fandom seems to have turned a corner as they have realized that the shouting Marco Polo wasn't funny 8 years ago, and it sure as hell isn't funny now.
Yeah.
I get the feeling that maybe it was just the oppressive 160-degree heat outside that just sort of drained everybody of the will to screw around.
Definitely a possibility. It was hot.
Yeah, holy crap. That was. I flew in, and I was just like, oh, my God, I'm so spoiled for L.A. weather.
I live in Florida, and it's summertime, and it was hotter in Baltimore than it is here.
Oh, God.
Oh.
Wow. All right, well, I think that sums up your Otakon experience. Mike, how was the show for you?
Well, I just love Otakon. It's got that big convention feel, but at the same time, I feel like I really have a handle on it, and it's fun to experience and get up close with the people. I tried to make the most of the weekend. I actually came in on Thursday, saw a ball game, threw a little party. That was good fun. And at the convention, I'd say some of the highlights were, of course, Daryl's Anime's Craziest Deaths, which I'm sure he can regale us with more tales of that. But dude, you had over 1,000 people in that room.
Yeah, I think it's like 1,600 is the capacity of that main 13, room.
1,300. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of people. It's the biggest crowd I've ever had for anything I've ever done. So the pressure was on to not drop the ball, and I think I ran with it.
It was quite impressive. My highlights were I always use Otakon as an excuse to get up and close with the Japanese creators. It's kind of deceptively easy there. They don't draw the big crowds. Like Saturday morning, there was a panel for Satellite, the studio. And there was a rep from there, a lady, her name was Akemi or something like that, and Hidetaka Tenjin, who does design work for them. And so they went through their current projects, including that really bizarre AKB 0048 anime. And they actually showed something that had never before been screened anywhere for any reason, and it was animation for a pachinko game for Macross Frontier. So brand new anime that no one had ever seen, complete with like revealing mistakes and stuff. It was really interesting to look at.
Yeah, and I was at that panel, and I think the most fascinating allegory of the entire Japanese anime industry was the fact that their laptop battery wasn't plugged in when they were running the panel. The battery died mid-panel. Rather than plug the thing in or switch out the battery, they switched out the entire laptop. And I think that's a very Japanese way of doing things in the face of a minor setback.
Hey, man, it worked, right? It worked.
It did work this time, at least.
That's all that mattered. There was that. I always encourage people to show up for these things because there are seriously maybe 50 or 60 people for that. For Yuka Nanri, the seiyu, who is the voice of Riko in Kids on the Slope, again, maybe 75, 100 people. And she impressed me. She has a lot of energy and commitment. She read most of the manga just to try and understand the characters. It's like she was able to speak intelligently at length, not just about Kids in the Slope, but about, like, you know, Mai Otome, about the other stuff that she had worked on, which that was pretty cool. And did sneak into the Aya Hirano concert on Sunday, and it was a big, stupid, crazy, you know, Seiyu Idol concert. She actually got a backing band who were very good, and it was a really fun experience. My only complaint, and it's a small one, is the year before this past year was really impressive for premieres. They had the new Fullmetal Alchemist movie, they had the new Makoto Shinkai movie, they had the dub premiere of the Trigun movie. This year they didn't really have anything. I was kind of hoping they'd sneak the first Berserk movie dub premiere in there somewhere, but no, there was nothing doing. But I mean, that's a small complaint at most. I've already booked a hotel for next year. You'll see me there again. I'm definitely going to present again if I can. Oh, that is one more thing. I did Dubs of Time for God as usual, and I also did a new panel called The Worst Anime of All Time.
I'm fascinated that title alone didn't like send a signal to put this in a really big room.
Yeah, that was daunting because I don't think I would have been able to break the 1,000-person mark like you did, Daryl, but I feel like I could have gotten 700 or 800 people in the room. As it was, I was crowded to capacity in a 400-person room.
I never would have gotten in if you hadn't like buzzed me in. Like, Mike, you'd reserve seats, and then the people up front didn't believe that you'd reserve seats, and they didn't let us in at first.
Yeah, but I mean, it was fun, and it was interesting to present because I didn't focus on stuff that was merely bad. I went after stuff that had serious technical issues, like the incredible animation mistakes in Megazone 2 3 Part 3, the unfinished cut of Gundress. That was the kind of territory I went into, and that got enough of a response. I'll probably revise and expand it for a convention in the coming year. I'll be back for Otakon next year. I don't know if I'm going to do Dubs That Time Forgot this time. I've been doing that every year since 2008 for Otakon. Feel like I could put it on the peg for a year. I have plenty of material, but it would be nice to do something else.
Well, I was actually impressed that you ran your panels off your iPad.
Oh yeah, that went stunningly well. You know, this is something that you, me, and several other people, Daryl, we have this challenge every year where you're ripping videos, you're transcoding, you're getting stuff from DVD, you're getting stuff from YouTube, you're getting stuff from BitTorrent, from this weird confluence of different sources, and the challenge is to try and get it all into one linear program using one piece of software on one platform. And I felt like for years, no matter what I did, there would always be something that would break down. And this year I used Keynote and my iPad, and I actually used my iPhone via Bluetooth as the control device for it, and it went perfectly.
Sounds pretty good. I would admit, like, it's foolish to put just the panel name, The Worst Anime Ever, like, just put that in the biggest room. Because, you know, people want blood. They're going to show up for that. Like, that's nuts. I would have put that in the biggest room we had. It's crazy. People eat that shit up. Especially if you're just complaining about terrible things. Anyway, so sounds like you had a great time. Daryl, how was your convention?
Real busy, real hectic, not a lot of sleep, but, you know, that generally means that you've got stuff to do, and I certainly had stuff to do since I was there as not just press, but also panels. So I was doing interviews. Unfortunately, since I'm not really the big shot interview, they were restricting interviews to 15 minutes, and so I would have loved to have grilled Hidetaka Tenjin and Gen Urobuchi and such for much longer than I had, but it wasn't to be. The funniest was the guest I really wanted to interview, Shin Sasaki. He's a producer for Gundam in Japan. And I was that was going to be my moment to sort of just finally get the Bandai Gundam man in a room and ask him the questions that the world has wanted to know. And he actually left the country rather than do the interview with me. So I'm just going to go out and publicize that that they were fearing the anime world order. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. But
well, they did an hour with Mike.
Yeah, I was going to say, no, Daryl, the problem is, I told you this on Twitter, I asked him all the questions.
He asked him all the questions. There were no more questions to ask.
Yeah, he felt like he was done, so he left.
Yep,
I'm sorry.
Well, at least somebody got him. And that will come up in the future. So that's my consolation.
Yeah, is that interview going to be published soon, Zach, or is it still in the boiler?
Soonish, it's in the boiler. I have a month's worth of four conventions interviews to post. That one is close to the top of the list in terms of priority, but it's still being transcribed. So
yeah, I was going to say I didn't step all over Mr. Sasaki as I'm sure some Gundam fans would have wished I did. I tried to keep it civil, but we went to some interesting places in the talk with him, with an animation runner from Gundam Unicorn and the lady who runs the Gundam theme park. So that was a fun interview, and I hope you all enjoy it when it does get published.
Yeah, it'll be soon. It'll be in August. I can say that. That's excellent stuff. Anyway, Daryl.
Yeah, back to what I was talking about. So, yeah, I did have my panel, Anime's Craziest Deaths, as Mike mentioned, and went well last year. This year they put me in the biggest room that they had, typically reserved for their major guests, and it filled the place up, and I was able to run 100% new footage compared to last year, which is not a feat that I'm likely to be able to repeat, because that sort of crazy, excessive 80s, 90s OAV style content isn't really coming out in as much frequency as it used to. But we are getting some uncut DVD Blu-ray releases of things that were sanitized for TV that I'm able to mine very memorably, you know, particularly Blood Sea, which I opened with. Now everyone is wanting to know, what the heck is that show? So Funimation is hopefully going to make some money on that. But yeah, that was how I directed everybody to the discotheque table, because time and again, a crazy death, horrific violence. Oh, yeah, discotheque's got this. Go and see them in the dealer's room. First dealer as soon as you walk in the room. But I also did...
Lots of poetry, I imagine.
There was a decent amount. Yeah, I mean, but yeah, I no... License rescue for Goku Midnight Eye. So, you know, that was my time to put that out there and say, hey, this thing exists. Someone get on that. I had another panel that was just real simple, real easy, but it always draws a crowd. Great anime openings. Myself and my co-hosts, Gerald and Clarissa, we each did our picks and ran and filled up a room. And that went very well, because it's a great way to introduce people to shows, saying, hey, look at this cool animation. This is what the show's name is. This is where you can get it. And we went through a bunch. We put a full list of everything we showed up on the Anime World Order website, animeworldorder.com, if anyone's curious. What did they show? And then I also did my loop on the third panel, as I mentioned. And I unfortunately was not able to attend Mike's Dubs That Time Forgot, because they scheduled loop on opposite Dubs That Time Forgot, which it's kind of fascinating, since you know, one of the infamous Dubs That Time Forgot picks is, of course, Lupin Secret of Mamo, which, because it was dubbed like four times. But no,
I
did.
We'll get back to that.
Back to that one.
Yeah.
In a minute. And, you know, it did surprisingly turn out fairly well as far as people showing up. I thought I had a little more time than I actually had. So I had to truncate it a bit. But the part I truncated was, oh, here's the, you know, 10, 15 years of relatively mediocre TV specials. I trimmed that down, but other than that, went quite well. Surprisingly, a lot of people just didn't know about most of the stuff. I was expecting the hardcore, you know, people who were there to call me out on, hey, this happened in the Castle of Cagliostro, not that. But no, surprisingly, most of the people who showed up really were mainly only familiar with Lupin due to the Adult Swim broadcast and also the Castle of Cagliostro. And other than that, like, a lot of the stuff they just never seemed to have heard of before, based on, you know, what I could perceive as the reaction.
I want to throw this out there real fast, just to see if anyone else agrees. Now, having watched this new Lupin show, and my memory of all the other Lupin stuff I've ever watched, Castle of Cagliostro is sort of the least interesting characterization of those characters.
It is definitely not the prototypical Lupin. It's a good movie. I just don't think it's a very good Lupin the Third. Debate to that, because if you go back, Mike's watching the first series now. Miyazaki did get his hand in there and put his spin on it fairly early on in the inception of Lupin as an anime character. A lot of people see Cagliostro first and they're like, wow, this is great. It's amazing. What else you got? And the only other thing that's kind of similar is the Fuma Conspiracy and maybe some select episodes of the TV series over the years, you know, like two episodes from the second and a couple from the first. But I think that as you go deeper into Lupin the Third, you realize, oh, those are the anomalies. The rest is a different deal altogether, and it's pretty great in its own right.
Yeah, my introduction to Lupin was Cagliostro and Fuma Conspiracy, so you can imagine the cognitive dissonance when I followed those two up with Mamo and Gold of Babylon.
Yeah, which were the other ones that were commercially released early on in the Streamline days. I'm just fascinated that the reason that Streamline was kind of able to get, you know, those ones is because you know, Cagliostro wasn't a success for about, you know, 5 or 10 years. It wasn't until like the 90s or so that people started realizing, you know what, this is actually a great movie. Yasuo Otsuka famously noted in an interview that you can actually see on the manga video DVD release that, you know, it feels kind of late now, guys. You know, what, where were you guys, you know, when I got busted and dropped down to TV jail, as it were, because this movie didn't hit it big.
That's a great interview. He seems pretty PO'd in that.
Wow. Okay. So that's Otakon. I'm really looking forward to attending it next year. I kind of miss the pure anime convention, which I feel like that is a much purer experience than AX.
For me, it's the big game, because when I think of AX, I don't even know if AX allows fan panels or not.
Yeah, no, they of course they do. It's just there's an attitude to that show that it feels a lot like Comic-Con, where it just kind of washes over you and you don't really notice other people. I don't know really how to phrase it. Like, it's in such a big space. It's in the LA Convention Center. And there's something to it where it's just, it feels impersonal. Maybe that's the word I'm looking for. It's impersonal. And I love AX. I've been going for 12 years or something at this point. Oh, God, 13 years.
One thing that has definitely changed about Otakon, though, is that it is now way more crowded. Like, you
33,000 people.
Yeah.
The biggest choke point used to be that skywalk where the first two panel rooms were. Now it is that small stairway connecting the convention center to the Hilton.
What a shitty design that is. That made me angry.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that became dangerous at times. Like, they had to just stop people from going on there for a while.
Yeah, between that and the heat, it was really, really difficult to traverse some of the areas. But fortunately, it wasn't like everyone's crammed like sardines, and that's the time you start blasting your boombox or whatever. There wasn't that much of that this year.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm looking forward to seeing the contrast again. I love both shows, and really looking forward to doing those next year.
Yeah, I really hope I can go next year too.
The next Anime World Order podcast that'll come out will be basically an hour and a half Otakon overview. So I'll leave the gory details to that for anyone who wants to hear that whole deal.
Okay, well, thanks for fucking my podcast, Daryl. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really appreciate that.
Yeah. Anyway. Screw this thing. I'm done. Ooh. Drop the mic and storm out. All drumline style.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. Okay, let's get to Twitter, because we gotta at some point get to this. All right. Mark FBR asks, what's a show, book, game, etc. that you like, but sort of feel ashamed that you do? I know Daryl has no sense of actual shame, so this doesn't apply to him, but Justin?
Oh, hold on, let me think. Can you come back to me?
Guilty, it's a guilty pleasure question.
Yeah.
Mike, anything?
Well, something that I picked up fairly recently that would seem to be beneath me, but no, it was cheap, so I got it. Gravion.
Oh, okay.
crazy Masami Obari fan service and Kunio Okawara robot. It's not a good show, but it's my kind of show.
I always, of all that kind of like crazy fan service with robot, I was personally geared towards Godanar more than Gravion. But
I've got that too. I've got him. Godanner is definitely better, but Gravion isn't that bad. And it was literally like $11 for the whole thing. So, yeah, I'm down.
I think right now for me it's the manga UK dub of Legend of the Dragon Kings.
Well, I think it means
Soryuden.
You're watching that? You told me you would not watch that, and you're watching it.
It goes in the player, and I just kind of leave it on in the background, and I like hearing how stilted the voices are, and it kind of makes me happy, and I don't know why. Because I had to subtitle that show when I was at CPM, and the ending is so bad that I actually jumped out of my seat and started yelling at the subtitle station.
Well, that show in general, that's definitely the nadir of the great Osamu Dezaki's career right there, I'm thinking.
And it's the guy that wrote Legend of the Heroes.
Yoshiki Tanaka.
Yeah, but it is a bad show, and I don't know, something with that and the stilted British cast trying to sound American, it just, I don't know, it's just cheese that smells a little off, but I can't help sniffing it.
Wow. Well, I'm pretty sure Mark was referring to anything, not necessarily just anime.
So you could have like embarrassing music selections.
Yeah, well, yeah, anything you like, but feel ashamed that you do like it. I mean, my stuff in that regard is sequestered to television, for the most part. I mean, I'm a big Paul Verhoeven fan, and some people would call his stuff guilty pleasures, but.
I do not. Come on.
I kind of don't either. Like, I feel like people who call those guilty pleasures are not aware of the level of satire that they're operating on. Mm-hmm. But in terms of television, I watch some truly embarrassing shit.
Yes, you do.
Hey, we're all Storage Wars fans here, right?
Well, yeah.
I actually haven't really seen much Storage Wars, but I know everybody I know is crazy for Storage Wars.
It's the trucker speed of television, man. It's cheap. It gives you a buzz, and then it's gone.
I actually do have a thing for absolutely terrible 80s music videos. My personal favorite right now, I have two. One is My Obsession by Mary D. Marshall. The only 80s starlet with an eraser head haircut.
Okay.
What about What's on Your Mind, Pure Energy by Information Society?
Well, that's not a bad video. Well, for its day, it's not a terrible video.
That hairstyle on the lead singer, man, gets me every time.
Oh yeah, that's freaking crazy. And then my for outright just ridiculousness, there's this obscure Italo disco song called "Colder Than Ice" by Grant Miller, and this music video seriously looks like it was shot in my high school TV station.
Well, dude, Italo disco in general, that is like that's the music of the future from the past.
Right.
That's a great guilty pleasure right there.
Oh God, it's so bad, and it looks like, you know, the it's just switching between two cameras, this like well meaning guy just singing politely with like old prom decorations rescued from the garbage behind him. It's just delightful on a terrible level.
If I had to name one thing that I enjoy, but I won't like at all put up a resistance or fight if someone says it's total garbage, I'll cop to it that I do read a lot of current mainstream Marvel DC comics. Yeah. And so if anyone is going to like take me to task for being like, oh, you know, the typical problems of American comics, I'll be like, yep, I am fully aware that, you know, the Suicide Squad is this way or Deathstroke is that way or what have you. And I will not really begrudge anyone for saying that's not their bag. But that's about, like, the limit of my my no-shameness or my shameness.
Yeah, bringing it back to Storage Wars for just a minute, Mike. I just wanna,
where's the Storage Wars Marvel comic?
I just want to point out that it has made it possible to where it's extremely funny, where every time you have a piece of garbage in your hand, like an empty paper bag or like a fast food cup or something, you can say, this is a $100 bill all day. Like, because yeah, Storage Wars.
Hey, anyway. if they ever feel the need to make an American Doctor Who, Barry Weiss. That's all I'm saying.
Fucking Storage Wars. Watching people sift through abandoned garbage. Literally what American television, that show has like 5-6 million people watching it. And it's just crusty dudes sifting through abandoned trash,
and it's reality TV, so in some aspects it's totally contrived.
Yeah,
and staged.
It's all staged,
but you just don't care. It's great.
Yep. The next step, of course, is Storage Wars fanfic.
Yeah, I'm sure that exists. No,
oh, it does.
Yeah, I've seen Storage Wars webcomics. Those are pretty great.
I'm waiting for the show where they just have guys dumpster diving and then they approximate the value of like the day old bread that they found. Like, that's got to be the next step, because Annie's, like, entire schedule is dudes sifting through trash. Like, I think American Pickers is on the History Channel, but, yeah, so much of that is happening. But I'm really ashamed that I watch most of The Real Housewives, so there you go. Let's see.
Wow, I've never gone there.
Yeah, what can I say?
Good luck to you.
I'm going to shoot myself into space. All right. Big on Anime asks, do you think Legend of the Galactic Heroes will ever get licensed?
Yes.
Yes.
I think that now that there's not so much of a physical DVD demand to actually fill shelf space, that actually seems like a prime candidate for a digital distribution, like a stream or something like that. Because if you think about it, some of those really long shows, you know, put it up on streaming. And it can happen.
See,
well, they already
I mean,
subtitled the whole thing professionally. There's nothing stopping them from doing that.
Yeah, right. There's that. I mean, basically, I've been wildly over-optimistic about the franchise from the beginning. You know, when they dubbed a couple of episodes for marketing purposes, I was just like, oh, well, they're going to release it. When they did this ridiculous pre-order campaign to try and get interest up, I thought, oh, well, they're going to release it. Now they're releasing it commercially in France, and I'm just thinking, yeah, of course they're going to release it. Why wouldn't they? I've felt that way the whole time, and I just wonder why. Well, what's taking them so long? It's obvious. There's demand there. They just need a way to tap into it.
Well, I feel like they need to figure out what the exact demand is and then tailor the release to that, because that's a niche thing.
Yeah, that's got a discotheque release all over it, I think.
Mm.
Yeah.
I'd welcome it.
Yeah, I mean, they were able to, you know, pull off not only a stream, but also physical DVD releases of that entire original Fist of the North Star. And they're still in business, so there is a demand for this stuff, you know, as minuscule to the mainstream as it may seem.
In fact, they seem to be kind of thriving. Like, they're making the whole, you know, just sell a few thousand units of stuff work for them. It's really something.
Yeah, I believe NISA is doing generally the same thing. They're being smart about what they release, when they release it, how they release it, how many they print. I'm pretty sure that people who are not aiming to also have ADV toys and ADV music and ADV whatever the fuck magazine and all that shit, like, they're doing okay because they're managing their expectations. It's not just this sort of Pac-Man capitalism. But anyway, all right.
Yeah, I do think it could happen.
Yeah,
I think it will.
I think it could. I don't know that it will. That someone's got to have to decide that that's worth the risk.
Yeah, it's up to somebody in Japan also realizing that it's just not really worth that much.
Yeah, that's the other thing. It's about 100 episodes?
Oh, more than that.
Yeah.
Once you factor in the side story OAVs as well, and then
the movies
and that Golden Wings and all that stuff, it's up there.
At least
150 plus.
I do always check the AX schedule every year just to make sure that my Conquest is the Sea of Stars is playing. Like, I always check. That and Tenchi Muyo in Love, because they typically have a 35mm film room.
That used to be a thing at Otakon, and then it's basically has faded away because, I guess, you know, how many 35mm prints can you get?
Yeah, not many. All right, moving on. Video Dragon asks, ask Daryl when you're doing JoJo's Part 5 review and Part 6 and Part 7.
As fate would have it, we just, right after Otakon, we had another local convention here in Florida to hit where we did JoJo's Bizarre Adventure panel where we covered all the parts up through JoJolion. And so it is indeed possible that we can do a podcast review of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure Part 5 because it is sort of it's fresh in our hands if you want the gold experience and such. It is possible at the same time. The new semester is about to start, and my co-hosts are in grad school, so there's always that sort of holding it back. But, hey, we're getting a new JoJo's TV show. We're getting a new JoJo's video game. The time is soon, I think.
It's a JoJo-gasm.
How much JoJo's have any of you guys seen? Are you familiar with it?
I saw the original series years ago, and I keep meaning to revisit it, and I never do.
Yeah, I've got like 3/5 of the OVA DVDs because, you know, you can't get the last two discs. But
disc that's actually worth the huge money.
Yeah, I've got 1 through 3, and I know you can get 5 and 6 really easily. But yeah, 4 is like gone for some reason. But
yeah, that's because, you know, it's got the anime's craziest death right there up at the
beginning. Yeah, I mean, I've done that. I've read parts of part 1 and part 2 of the manga, and I played the original 2D fighting game. That's my experience, so I know it pretty well.
Okay. Yeah, I'm hoping that the new TV show hits it off because based on the promotional video, if that does well enough, they might just run through as much as they can. But it's definitely starting at part 1.
Hmm. Well, that'd be cool.
Yeah, that's it's either next season or the season after this one coming up. But it's soon. I think it's the next season.
Nice. Yeah, it was my impression that it was October.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
We will find out. No, I played the video game in an arcade cabinet, believe it or not.
oh, yeah. JoJo's Ventures.
Yeah. And I read, like, the first 2 volumes of the manga. but that's about it. Okay. IMS Bionics asks, what series would you want an SD spinoff? Would you want it to be a comedy, or would you try and juxtapose things and be as serious as can be?
Well, since I just showed and blew the minds of people by showing people clips from Penguin Memories at the last convention I went to, juxtaposing the cutesy images with the really serious storyline doesn't seem to work very well, at least if the intention is to actually be dramatic.
Yeah. Maybe I'm alone on this. I never really found any NESD spinoffs to be funny. Like, it's all based on, it's the same, like, let's overreact to everything and look at me, you know, having this expression isn't that funny.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm very fond of the original SD Gundam specials, but those
I was just going to say those are
super nerdy and in-joke.
Yeah, super in-joke heavy. Same thing with the AIC UMIX stuff, like Scramble Wars and Tenable Golf Force, really in-joke intensive. You know, they did do a little SD Fist of the North Star that was like, you know, them in modern-day contemporary, like, convenience stores and stuff, which is also, you know, all this, it's very meta humorish. And
same with Lodos. They did Welcome to Lodos Island,
which is superior to the actual Lodos TV show.
I know, it's terrible, but
man, that's a low bar.
Yeah.
You know, an SD Legend of the Galactic Heroes would probably be pretty similarly clever, like the original SD Gundam and stuff. You could load it up with all sorts of in-jokes and weird, you know, historical lore and go to town with it. But yeah, as a rule, I'm not really ever looking at something and thinking, you know what, I really want an SD spinoff.
Well, it's such a simple and played-out joke. It's just like, oh, here's something serious, and now they're cute. You know, it's just there's only so much you can do with that. And I feel like after 20 or 30 years, they've kind of exhausted all the potential of it.
Yeah, they need to go more the Chibi Gona Guy route.
Hey, picture SD Wounded Man.
Yeah.
You know, take any crazy, you know, kill crazy, murder happy Kazuo Koike title and run it through the SD filter. It's great because, you know, there's no way it's not going to be about murder, but they'll all be cute and stuff.
That's but, pretty good, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it you could go interesting places with it, but yeah, it is kind of a shallow joke.
Yeah, I have to admit, like, I feel like that's been exhausted in terms of anime and what they could do with that there. But American films, I would really love to see some SD stuff. So, like, Super Deformed, The Seventh Seal, or El Cid. Let's get an SD comic based on El Cid.
I will say the one place where SD works as proper, dramatic, awesome narrative is video games. The Super Robot Wars games are fantastic. And it's not that I want to see things in SD. I just want to get more of the real ones out in a format I can read.
Oh, yes.
All right.
I want SD Angela's Ashes.
SD Serpico.
Hey, SD Serpico I would fucking devour. That would be amazing. That would be incredible. All right, moving on. AC in 715 asks, what are your thoughts on Toonami so far, and what shows would you like to see on it?
Black Lagoon, man. Yeah. I think that would be a perfect fit.
Oh, that's a good one, yeah.
I really think that, you know, obviously Toonami for its day was instrumental because it made anime cool. It made anime accessible to people who don't watch anime. In its current time slot, it's a little challenged to do that, especially since it's also running reruns. But I think I would like to see Toonami sort of get some movies in there. I mean, get Redline on a show. Get, like, sort of The Stranger. You've got a Full Metal Alchemist movie. You've got a Trigun movie. That's stuff that you could put on TV and show it to people and get people at least interested, even though it's in a pretty rough time slot. I think that's where Toonami needs to go. Get some strikingly, you know, visually unique shows that are like got really good English dubbing that aren't like super heavy duty, like Japanese cultural. You know, Michiko and Hachin, now that that's finally coming out, I think that would be a perfect fit. For that late night.
Yeah, I have I haven't seen the new Toonami. I don't have linear cable anymore, but I'm glad it's back. I also wish it was a little more visible. In terms of what I would like to see, yeah, I'm kind of shocked that, you know, they didn't try and make a play for Tiger and Bunny. Maybe that was already locked up with Viz's new thing. But when they first started talking about bringing that back, that seemed the perfect.
That was the first thing out of my mouth. Yeah, that and Penny and Stocking. But I mean, you know, and obviously Funimation would kill for that to be on air. Obviously, I imagine Cartoon Network is probably the one with reservations on that.
Yeah, Penny and Stocking is pushing it.
They also have virtually no acquisition budget, I'm told.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I'm sort of thinking, like, you know, the way to impress people. I mean, Samurai 7 is gorgeous visually, but all people like who don't really know about anime are going to think if they see Samurai 7 is, well, this isn't as good as the Seven Samurai. And to be honest, very little things are as good as the Seven Samurai. But I think that's not the impression you want to give.
Yeah, I think Samurai 7 is also a disappointing choice because that thing has been in reruns on IFC for years. You know, that's not like an interesting new thing or hard to watch or hard to acquire. It's been around in this country for like 8 years.
Yeah, they probably have an exclusive on it still as well.
I mean, much as I would love for Detroit Metal City to run opposite Metalocalypse, I think it's a little too raw for even for that midnight show time schedule. But I think if it happened, that would be a powerful force.
While we're at it, why not ask for Ebby Chu?
Dude, Ebby Chu has one joke.
Yeah,
it really does.
But, yeah, I mean, there's a ton of shows that could get people interested in anime and at least do something functionally similar to what Toonami originally did. And even Toonami in the later years when they started getting, like, Fooly Cooly and the like in their later night time slots, which is get people to think, oh, wow, this is interesting and different. But we live in a world where people have seen so much that... you know, just the running the nostalgia rerun stuff is only going to, you know, get you so many people. And it's not going to convert anybody, in my
opinion. Actually, that new Lupin would probably be a pretty good pick.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean,
although they'd have to cut the crap out of it.
Well, they'd have to do some sort of editing.
Every episode would be 14 minutes long on account of taking out all the nudity.
Maybe they could paint over with digital bikinis again, like how they did on Tenchi and 8th MS Team.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Let us never speak of the digital bikinis again.
Like, I meant to mention this before, but that new Lupin show, like, if it were a comic, I would say that it would be most at home being serialized in a Playboy, like, at the end of the 60s, maybe the beginning of the 70s. That is what the show feels like, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, the original Lupin comic was conceived as a comic for adults, and the anime was the first... anime, like Japanese cartoon, that was meant to be for adults, that original first series. And, you know, obviously the ratings didn't work out and it got retooled, you know, very quickly on. But yeah, I can see exactly where you're coming from on that.
Yeah, but I just couldn't see it actually running unless they just took a machete to it. Like,
yeah.
And which would be really awkward and weird and stuff.
It wouldn't be fair to the network or to the show.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. XB Sane asks, most disappointing show from this season, and what are you looking forward to from next season? I have not looked at the next season chart yet. I tend to put that off until it's actually happening to me. So I don't know for the next season.
Well, I mean, I started off trying to watch a few different shows, and one thing that did disappoint me, and I've dropped it as a result, is Sword Art Online. I don't know if any of you guys have checked that out.
Yeah.
It starts with a really interesting idea. Basically, people are trapped into a massively multiplayer online game, and if their character dies or if they try to exit, they die in real life.
Yeah.
And conceptually, that's very interesting to me, but it's a series of cheap cliches. It's only occasionally been effective. I made it through 4 episodes, and I dropped it. I feel like the concept has a lot more potential, and they just went the really formulaic route.
Yeah, that's what I heard about that, and so I didn't watch even another episode.
My expectations going into the season were so low that I'm just kind of grazing and picking up what everyone else is talking about. And you know, the fun thing about having low expectations is that you're never disappointed. So the fact that I even found Natsuyuki Online made my season, even though it's not that great.
Yeah, I will admit to being a touch disappointed in Humanity Has Declined. I don't know. I think we referenced this idea earlier, but the idea of that show, I feel like, is a little bit better than the execution of that show. But
well, if you want to see a truly effective world winding down thing, you don't watch Humanity Is Declined. You watch Yokohama Shopping Diaries.
Yeah, or you'd rather you fall asleep 10 minutes in to Yokohama Kaidashi Kiko.
There's actually, believe it or not, nothing newly begun during the season that I'm watching right now. For next season, I already mentioned there's going to be a JoJo's Bizarre Adventure anime. There's also going to be a Lychee Light Club anime, which is going to be an interesting thing to behold. More Jormungand, which, you know, come to think of it, that might be a pretty good potential Toonami pick late night. Obviously, I'd prefer Black Lagoon over that. There's more Initial D, but mostly the stuff I'm looking forward to in the next season, it's theatrical films, and I don't know how much of that stuff we're even going to get here. I mean,
yeah, they're actually doing the third and final MARDOK Scramble movie, which I'm excited for. The 80, yeah,
new Cyborg 009.
Yep. Yeah, Sentai Filmworks actually did point out that they are releasing the second one. They are waiting for materials for the director's cut because they don't want to do a standard cut and director's cut as separate releases. They didn't know that was going to be the case. They thought they had the whole movie. Yeah. So the second one is coming for U.S. release, and that's, I enjoyed the first one, so I'm looking forward to it.
I will totally watch that.
Yeah,
I wouldn't say I enjoyed the first MARDOK Scramble, but it was definitely really interesting and. I was quite taken with it just as something like, hey, they don't make this kind of thing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it. Daryl, thank you for mentioning Initial D. I forgot about Initial D, and I'm really foaming at the bit for that. And I know Funimation won't dub it because the previous releases just tanked for them, as one would expect of what is ostensibly a sports anime. Yeah. But, I hope that there is some way that we can see that legally in this country, because it's airing twice a month on pay-per-view over there. And so I'm not sure that there is an easy and business-compatible route for it to take to the U.S., but I hope there is.
All right. Vinny Ann of AGC asks, what do you think the possibility and chance of success would be of a Kickstarter for a classic anime release, say for Wicked City?
Kickstarter success, I feel, is tied to what the financial target is and also what the rewards are. If you have interesting rewards, yeah, I think it'll succeed. And if your financial target isn't unreasonable, like if you're shooting for $40,000 or $50,000, I think it could be done. But I mean, it depends on what is needed to be spent on something like Wicked City. It's like, if you're going to go Blu-ray on that, what kind of materials do you have? What kind of new work is going to need to be done?
Yeah. Kickstarter, I think, I feel like it's over.
I feel like it's been co-opted for some things that it's maybe not necessarily originally intended for. Like, I'm still highly skeptical that there was ever a need to do Kickstarters for Osamu Tezuka manga. You know, that's was going to sell anyway at this point. Well, we've had many years.
I liked the idea of the Barber Kickstarter, and I was on board with that. I feel like the follow up Kickstarter for Unico and the rest. I think that was deeply cynical. I think Unico, regardless of how you package that, was going to be a surefire success.
Yeah, that's a Sanrio thing, man. Yeah, it aired on TV and like the Disney Channel back in the day. People at least have some awareness of Unico.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, this is how do I remove the risk from this investment?
Yeah, and that's not what Kickstarter was originally conceived for. Yeah.
Right. I think what people might use it for is risky Blu-ray re-releases. Like, I could totally see potentially Discotech maybe using it for a Venus Wars Blu-ray, because Blu-rays have pretty high startup cost, and there's a lot of hemming and hawing that goes on. It's like, oh, I'm not sure if I'm going to make back this investment for older titles. So maybe that. I don't know.
And the thing is, you know, I'll say right now, for something like a Blu-ray of Venus Wars, if you included a reward, like something along the lines of a translated PDF of all the production materials, I'd pay like $50 or $75 for that. So yeah, that's something that I think you could definitely do.
Well, there goes all the budget.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have a problem if a company is like, hey, if we just invest it, we're not going to make our money back, but you said you wanted it. So here's your chance to tell us that you're going to buy it when we put it out. Here's your chance to pledge your money. Like, I don't really have a problem with that, especially because anime on physical media is, as Justin predicted, is kind of becoming this little tiny thing. And so if you actually do want your Legend of the Galactic Heroes on a physical Blu-ray disc with packaging and all that other stuff, yeah, you have to give us $100 up front, and then we'll produce it. But not until enough of you actually pay for it. Like, I do kind of get that, but I know that that's not what Kickstarter is supposed to be. That's not what that's really for. Lance Highskull, you're a friend of mine. Frequent guest on this podcast. Honcho at Funimation asks, in order of rank, who is manliest? Gogo 13, Cobra, and Lupin the...
In terms of manliness, well, my list, the number one for me would be Cobra, because he's got really honest charm and genuine affection for his paramours and the people he works with. And I know that's, you know, that's not necessarily what you read seinen manga for, but that to me is kind of the manly ideal. Lupin is number two, because he's a fun-loving sociopath. And let's face it, Gogo 13 isn't a man, he's a machine.
Yeah, he's a force of nature.
Yeah.
I mean, Takao Saito famously noted that, you know, he basically does consider Gogo 13 like, you know, the perfect, you know, machine as far as doing what he does and doing it perfectly. Yeah, but maybe in this modern era, maybe being the perfect machine is being the perfect man.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting thought. I mean, I just think it's interesting that it's hilarious how in every Gogo 13 story, the woman falls into his arms, because that's the male fantasy. He doesn't actually exude.
Yeah, he
any
doesn't have
real
to
charm.
Initiate. They ask you. That is the male fantasy.
Yeah,
and then you're like, okay.
Yeah, and the big upside of Cobra is Buichi Terasawa's character is he's this lovable rogue, but no, he seriously has to work to win Jane Royal over.
Yeah,
and that's cool. I like that.
Yeah, I don't think I can argue with that logic.
No.
Right. I think at this point, the whole use of the adjective manly for anime is kind of like a little stretched out. I think at this point, if your show has an adult male protagonist in it, that's enough for it to be filed under manly anime. Because think of how rare it is that you get a show with an adult male protagonist in this modern day and age.
Think about what a risk it was to, you know, Tiger and Bunny, where the main character is over 30 and has a kid. Like, they were seriously worried about that, and I saw it, and it was like, no, this makes perfect sense.
Yeah. All right. Trick the TM asks, which unreleased in America Lupin the Third material, yeah, a lot of Lupin questions, do you want to see as Discotech's next release?
I've been pretty partial to the Alcatraz Connection, and that's a really solid one with some really great animation. I think it took them a couple of years to get the hang of the whole digital animation thing, and I think Alcatraz was the first one where they really could shine with that. There was also Operation Return the Treasure, which is by a really hugely underrated director that Mike and I are fans of, by the name of Jun Kawagoe, who is typically the guy who they go to for a lot of the Gonagai OAV Super Robot revival efforts. He's a really solid action director, and that special overall is a lot of fun. I think those two they definitely deserve to be seen by more people.
I didn't know Jun Kawagoe had directed a Lupin special. I'll have to check that out. My go-to pick would be the Return of Paikal OVA, partly just because since they released the original series now, you have the original chapter of that story. And it's a really good, solid little OVA, and there's a hook to the original TV series there, but you don't need to understand exactly how it ties in to enjoy it.
Yeah, that one I was always like a little split on it, because part of the appeal of Lupin initially was anytime when they would show adversary that seemingly had outlandish supernatural or superhuman powers, they'd always reveal it to be some sort of charlatan trickery. And then by the time of, you know, Return of Paikal and some of the later like Sweet Lost Night and such, it's like, no, he really does have magical powers, or no, this guy really does have a time machine. And yeah. I always felt that that's kind of over the line of what I want the suspension of disbelief for Lupin to be. That was kind of where I was always sort of objecting to Legend of the Golden Babylon. It's like, there actually are space aliens. And I was like, oh, this is a little out of place.
Well, but, since there's not a true canon for Lupin, I feel like it can go there.
Yeah, I mean, it's like saying which is the real Batman. Is Brave and the Bold acceptable, or is the animated series? I like both.
Yeah, I've only actually seen what's been released here, so.
Yeah.
Well, a surprising amount of it has been released here. Of course, again, you know, the way that Funimation got the specials, a lot of them were just really mediocre to average, such that, you know, the couple that were good, it was actually about half that were good, but it was mixed in with, like, you know, this, like, oh, well, here we go.
And, really dreadful stuff.
Yeah, I did see Goodbye Liberty Crisis, which I remember as being...
I'm not a fan.
Holy crap, that is a story about computers written by someone who had never used one.
Well, yep, that was, and I feel in fairness, that was the first one.
It was the first one. It was Osamu Dezaki, 1989. I feel like Discotech is probably going to put that one out because it did get a dub in the UK that never came out here. It's not that good of a dub, but, you know, it's a curiosity.
I don't know. I always like Tony Barry as Fujiko. She's a cute voice. I don't know.
Yeah,
you know me and my UK dubs.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing. That's one thing I thought about when I was watching the woman named Fujiko Mine. It was the Japanese voice.
The Funimation dub of that is not. I'm not looking forward to it.
I don't want to watch it. It's no offense to the actors who are going to be in it. No offense to the guy directing that dub. Those characters are innately, they speak in Japanese with those voices.
Well, since we're talking,
I think there are some fantastic Loop on the Third dubs, but I think if Chris Sabat and Sonny Strait and those guys, maybe they just fix some of the pronunciation issues, like those Funimation Lupin dubs, they would say Fujiko Mine as her name.
Ooh.
You know, and it was grating.
They weren't all that attentive. I mean, if we're on the subject of language, that's another thing about the Fujiko Mine series I liked a lot, is they had to recast her because the original actress is getting on in years. She's in her 70s. And yeah, Miyuki Sawashiro as Fujiko, she just kills it. I'm kind of hoping they could get her for Otakon next year. I'd like to meet her.
Yeah, they actually, she started, I guess, as of last year's special with, I guess, the mermaid one. But... yeah, I like her a lot as Fujiko, and it was really just long overdue that Fujiko had to be recast, along with Zenigata. I'm surprised that that Jigen is, you know, still holding out, but he can get away with it because Jigen's an old man.
Yeah.
Yeah, but again, when I see those characters, I hear the Japanese voices in my head. I don't hear the dubs. I, you know, didn't really care for the Genion dubs, like... whatever, those are Japanese characters to me. Like, that's how I watch that show. So, yeah, anyway. All right, Fist of the MFK. This is mostly a question for Justin. At Otakon, David Williams said that 10,000 units sold for an anime release used to be a low number, and now 3,000 is a hit. Is this industry-wide? Now, one caveat.
I know Funimation reps immediately said it is not how they think.
Lance High School immediately said we don't license anything that we think will only sell 3,000 units. But Justin, I'm curious about your take on this.
Well, if you look at Sentai and what they release, their bar is clearly much lower for a lot of their titles.
Yeah,
I always felt like when I look at Sentai's releases that they pick what they release based on what can be reverse imported from Japan. Like if you go to Amazon JP and you look at what the top selling things there are, it's all stuff that Sentai's got.
I think that's definitely a factor. And one thing worth remembering with Sentai, too, is I don't think Funimation has this arrangement, but a lot of the dubs that they're making for their Blu-rays, they are getting production assistance from overseas broadcasters who want to use those dubs for their TV broadcast.
Yep.
Yeah. David did mention that at the Sentai panel. He said that there are some titles that they jump on because they have partners who want English versions, and Sentai wants to be the ones to make those English versions.
Yeah, the Philippines are basically, you know, the home ground of dubs that Time Forgot at this point.
Right. And
there
are still several of those productions I really want. But at any rate, 3,000 is actually a fairly strong number for a sub-only release. For a dub release, you definitely want to do a lot more than that because they are still a lot more expensive. So, you know... Different rules for different shows. It's hard to state an average.
Right. Yeah. That's a hit for them.
Right.
That doesn't mean that it's a hit for Funimation or anyone else. Although I would imagine Funimation maybe might be the only company where they don't look at that as doing well.
I'm glad that that you can have shows that only sell a few thousand units but still get released. I mean, I feel like there's a market for stuff like that, even if it's sub only.
Side anecdote, at Otakon, they were selling the Bandai Visual Pat Labor movie box sets, the really nice ones, $15 each. And yeah. I think as a combined efforts of the Best of the 80s and Best of the 90s podcasts, those all sold out.
Oh, I mean, the funny thing is, yeah, those sold out through Right Stuff. They ended up restocking. They sell well through Amazon. The problem is they tried to sell those for $75 and no one wanted them, and they just never understood. No, the people want that stuff, but they want to pay $25 for it, or maybe 15, you know?
Yeah. I had to snag the movie one box just because I believe that's the only time an entire Ekante storyboard has been translated.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right.
They didn't do it for the second book.
Yeah.
No. But it's a gorgeous piece of work, and it's one of those things that if you see it, snag it, because we're never going to get anything like that again, because there's just no way you can make something that shiny and price it at $25. You just can't.
Yeah, I mean, and like Justin says, the whole storyboard is translated as a book, and there's a full-length art and production notebook as well. If you're a student of animation and just an anime buff, that's probably, those movies are probably the best DVD releases we've ever gotten on these shores.
Too bad about the dub.
Yeah, I know. Too bad about Elastic Media and their cast of One Take Charlies.
Sigh.
I should point out, though, that those Best of the 80s and Best of the 90s shows, a lot of people listen to those. Those were very popular.
Yeah, I think those are our biggest hit shows ever now.
No, I don't. Over time.
Bigger than the Carl Masek one?
No, I don't think so. Well, that's been out for years at this point. Look, so.
All I want to know is, when are we going to go into the studio and do Best of the 60s? There's a huge development.
We need a Best of the 70s, man.
Mike, you can go into your room and do that, and that will be the show.
I tell you what, Mike, the AWO will do the Best of the 70s. You can be on it.
Hey, if you guys want to do a Best of the 60s and Best of the 70s show, I'll help out with that. That'll be fun.
That may be a future project then.
All right, we'll talk.
Okay,
I'm just looking over here. The Pat Labor 2 storyboard book is also translated.
Okay,
wow,
been that long since I've.
Oh, you know what? I think it's called
Jinro book.
Jinro, where you got all the materials from the Japanese release, but they didn't translate any of it.
Yeah, when Bandai released Gundam model kits and kept the instructions in full Japanese.
All right, moving on. Starpunk 83 asks, Mike, he's seen that you're watching first Lupin season. Are you enjoying it?
I'm enjoying it a great deal, and it's interesting how the Miyazaki and Takahata episodes differ from the non-Miyazaki Takahata episodes. And I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the gentleman who directed the first 9 episodes. But, I mean, they tend to either be just really simple and straightforward, or they take a really interesting left turn. And they're not that sophisticated, but there's always at least a few cuts of animation per episode that are very surprising and very ambitious, and they're just fun. My only complaint is it is definitely the kind of material that I wish I could watch dubbed, so I wouldn't have to watch the screen continuously all the time. It's that kind of show. There are times when I'm on, I watch it 3 episodes at a time, and I'm in that middle episode, and my attention is kind of wavering. Dub would help out with that, but I mean, overall, the whole series for, $40 to $50, and the extras are just great. There's a lot of production notes and a lot of little tidbits in there.
Yeah, some great commentary tracks. Reed Nelson really went above and beyond the bar. That dude's the man.
Since you dropped his name, Daryl, I'll actually use this point to point out that we're working on the final details, but it's looking like I will be writing an essay as an extra for the Discotheque release of Secret of Mamo.
Nice.
Woo.
Yeah. And you can thank Reed for that, because he was kind of dropping hints to me that he wanted me involved in some way with that movie, since I've been championing it for years. I'm very excited about it. I like Mamo a lot, and it's going to be a great release.
Okay. Cowboy Dev asks, what's been your favorite anime release this year thus far? Anybody?
In terms of domestic or Japanese, I guess all-encompassing.
Let's reinterpret this question to favorite region 1 anime release.
I would say, I'm going to go with the low-hanging fruit, just because it's within visible eyesight of where I'm sitting right now, and say the Discotheque re-release of the professional Go-Go 13, if only because they also include the commentary track by the late, great Osamu Dezaki, as well as an additional commentary by Jonathan Clements, and, you know, some great remastered video. You know, my hat's off to the mysterious benefactor who pulled that one off. Maybe he's listening or right here.
All right.
Not me. I'm going to recuse myself from this question.
Okay. Yeah, you can.
Well, then Space Adventure Cobra. Oh, well, that's another one, I guess.
That would be mine. Yeah, Space Adventure Cobra. Very happy that that's available legally and you can just buy it. That's great. Mike?
I definitely put in a vote for Cobra. The other release I've been really enjoying lately that I've watched through a couple of times is the UK release of Rogen Z.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty good underrated movie, and I got one of them newfangled, you know, all region Blu-ray players, and UK Blu-rays are pretty inexpensive to get from Amazon. It's opening up all kinds of new avenues for me, and it's a shame that you can't get it easily. But yeah, Rogen Z is out there on Blu-ray, and it's a cool movie.
Yeah, I gotta buy one of those just so I can get the Mystery Science Theater 3000 movie Blu-ray. Which is only in the UK at this point. Fuckers. Okay. Penguin Truth asks, how many shows taking place in a high school do we need in one season?
All of them.
Every single last show.
I think that is a little telling how focused the Japanese otaku scene is on, you know, calling a mulligan on their high school years. And getting that perfect high school experience or that innovative high school experience.
I think these Japanese otaku really need to sit down and watch the 21 Jump Street movie, because that cast such a great light on the whole idea of trying to go back and do high school right.
It really did, didn't it?
Yeah. It was a great movie.
That's a very
I really enjoyed that. But, you know, it's not just the otaku culture. It seems like all of Japan is like that. A good third of TV dramas that take place in the high schools, a good half of their movies.
You'd always hear people talk about how it's because high school is like the last time when they're free, and afterwards, you know, their whole life path is set based on what college you get into and et cetera, et cetera. But I, for my money's worth, it's like, come on, mix it up, guys. The beauty of anime is its versatility. And the problem isn't that there's a show set in a high school or this type of show or that type of show. It's that there's just too many, like, tipping the balance on any one particular side. And I mean, anytime I complain about a certain type of show, it's really an overabundance of that at the time. In the 90s, I was complaining about, like, oh, this Ninja Scroll crap. Nowadays, I'm like, Ninja Scroll, let's get more of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the great things about the Space Brothers anime, about the story of it, is the fact that you have the main character who's in his mid-30s. He has an impressive faux pas at work. He gets fired. But then it's presented as kind of this positive thing where he gets to start over. And I feel like, you know, there should be more storytelling like that. That's good stuff.
You know, I always think that if that much of a society is that focused on the best years of their life being in high school, that is a really unhappy society.
Yeah,
the Crayon Shin-Chan Adult Empire Strikes Back tried to warn us, but it was to no avail.
Yeah,
no one saw it here.
That's I think is one of the biggest cultural differences between Japan and America when it comes to pop culture, is that high school is really not seen as the best. Like, people who peak in high school are presented as these incredibly pathetic characters in our fiction and in our popular culture. Like, if you peaked in high school, congratulations, you suck. Like, and you're probably awful.
You lost the game of life.
Yeah.
Four touchdowns in a single game, Zach.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. Okay, moving on. Wraithnor asks, if you could pilot any mecha, what would it be and why? Let's start with Daryl.
Oh, wow. There are just so many, but, I'm personally a fan of maybe a Getter One or a Macross Valkyrie of some sort, because I like to fly around and, you know, chop things up. But yeah, there's just infinitely many. I'm sure in terms of, like, you know, the nerd power levels, there's, you know, your Mazen Kaisers and your, you know, God Gundams out there. But yeah, I mean, I really just want to not have to deal with traffic in the morning at this point. You know, getting in a robot and crushing the cars in front of me is what I would be satisfied with that.
Yeah, I know, right? I think I wanted to pilot a Labor for that exact reason.
Mike?
Doesn't have to be an AV-98. Just can be any old Labor. I'll just take Labor.
You'd take the pickle.
Well, yeah. Technically, you'd be walking to work every day.
Damn it. That's right.
See, that's why my favorite mecha since I was a very, very young boy has been Grandizer. Because it's the best of both worlds, man. It's a giant robot and a flying saucer.
I know that Grandizer is huge, like, you know, in the, you know, foreign-speaking parts. I just can never get over how absolutely goofy it looks, even compared to the greater designs of Gonagai and Kenny Ishikawa. It's Grandizer just is silly, especially in the UFO mode.
It's a silly robot. I think my favorite aspect of it is that when Duke, the pilot, transfers from the UFO to the robot, there's a great cutaway scene where his command chair slides back and then down a ramp and then spins around in 360 degrees.
The arbitrary spin.
Yeah, and then proceeds into the robot cockpit. It spins for no reason at all, but I guess it just looks cool. I'm down.
I have to admit, if, you know, when asked this question, my first thought is, well, here's what I would really want to do. I would want to pilot a brain-powered mecha, if only so I could say, hey, okay, I'll be right back, and then people would have to watch me awkwardly climb into my robot's genitals. Like that.
Well, if you're thinking in terms of that, Zach, then the real mecha choice is anything from a Genesis of Aquarion, because it involves orgasming.
Yeah, I'll take that too. Okay, that too. But
brain-powered robots are also, you know, they're semi-sentient, and they're basically, you know, giant metal four-year-olds.
Yeah.
So you have that aspect, too.
It's just that the cockpit is in the balls. <It's> so weird. Anyway. All right. Alex Leavitt asks, you're a friend of mine, Alex Leavitt. What's the next step in improving anime conventions? Obviously, Otakon is trying a music event. Any ideas? Anybody?
I guess it's subjective what he means by improving. You know, I always have thought that anime conventions may not be the best venue for musical performances, but Mike can go into that in much more detail.
Yeah, I mean, I think I like the idea of a separate music festival. I'm not sure what the Otakon one is going to be like. I'm going to find out because that is Jam Project. They're going to bring in a band with them, and I've already booked a room for that. But, I mean, in terms of improving conventions themselves, that's a good question. I feel like as long as conventions at least continue to stay on message and promote Japanese animation, then they're in a pretty good place. My biggest issue has always been, you know, I worry when Daryl and I go to these shows and we're effectively bigger stars than, like, some of the Japanese guests. That kind of weirds me out.
I think if I had to pick one aspect of improving conventions, it'd be right now, conventions don't really know what to do with video rooms. They're there based on tradition, but they're sort of obsolete because anyone can watch anime on their own time. I think the next step for conventions would be to take an effort to get people back into video rooms by maybe combining them perhaps with some sort of live events, maybe mini panel or introductory thing for the video room, sort of combining like, hey, this is what this thing's about. Let's talk about it a bit. And now let's watch it. And now that it's over, let's talk about what we just watched. Something a little more actively engaging that you couldn't get just from watching something at home on your computer. That, to me, I think is sort of a unexplored frontier as far as conventions go.
You can sort of tell looking at the program guide that the video rooms are still programmed by like an old holdout from the, you know, ancient days of anime conventions, because it's all like this stuff that just hasn't, it's usually you can find stuff that just nobody has watched in 15 years. And
that's great. But I mean, if they could perhaps interest people to say, hey, it's not just some random weird thing that you pop your head in the door and what the hell is this? If maybe you set up a thing where you move some of your live events, to preface that, you know, for example, I mean, if I did a Lupin panel, I'd talk about Lupin, and then we'd watch Lupin. You know, that's an idea. That's just off the top of my head, though.
Yeah, they basically just need to do some marketing for that stuff. You can't just throw that in a video room because no one will go.
Yeah, video rooms are a hard sell, and they're idiosyncratic. I ran video for Katsucon for 3 years, and it was amazing to me how a lot of, you know, I'd say the majority of the shows would get 5 to 10 people. But there'd be these weird pockets of time where the rooms would be full. Like, I think the most well-attended showing I ever ran was for the first Detective Conan movie. And that was like, that was standing room only, like fire code threatening levels, like 600 people.
Wow.
Yeah. I didn't get it, but there they were.
Justin, I totally agree with your sentiment, and I always laugh because every time I look at any anime schedule, it doesn't matter the convention, sometimes even Comic-Con sometimes, I'll always see some old CPM stuff on there.
Right.
There will always be like World of Narue or like that will be on there for some reason.
Oh, Jesus.
And you're like, really? Like, so this dude just had this laying around. Like, that's why it's on there.
Although, one other thing that I always think about is I feel like that there has to be some way of making sitting in line for big events more entertaining. But whenever they do that, it ends up being a disaster.
Penny Arcade Expo has gotten that down to a science. They actually have, like, interactive stuff. You know, they actually have an entire segment of their volunteer staff that are devoted to line games.
That's cool. That's really cool.
Yeah, it's that's definitely something you could apply to Otakon or events of that level where you have times of the day where there's waits of an hour or more in very big lines.
Yeah, I feel like that wouldn't be too expensive because even if you just got like cheap TVs and DVD players, like you could go to a thrift store. Get some cheap TVs, get some cheap DVD players, wheel them out in front of this crowd that's going to be sitting here for 2.5 hours, and just run some shit, run some anime. Like, entertain these people with the anime that they claim to love.
You'd have to be careful about placement for that, because logistically I can tell you that if you put something interesting looking on a TV out in the hall, gawkers will stop and clog the hallway.
Sure, yeah, maybe that's not the greatest idea, but you know, something like that, you know, where you're entertaining the audience. No, that's a really good idea. Personally, I feel like anime conventions would be greatly improved if they did a lot more marketing for their Japanese guests and actually made people aware who these people are, why they should be excited. And that's not just like a purity thing. That's not just like, hey, this is an anime convention, you should care about this guy. But just a little bit more effort in terms of like educating, like, hey, you're coming here. This dude made the show that you love. Here's who he is. You get the chance to be in the same room as him. It's a big deal. Like something like that. Like just, I don't know, make it a little bit bigger deal out of that.
The problem is, as long as the demographic are teenagers, really, you know, they want to have that weird little run in with celebrity rather than actually having a meaningful experience with a someone creatively interesting.
Well, in contrast to that, I mean, Mike pointed out very astutely that at Otakon, Gennaro Bucci, you know, of Fate Zero and Madoka Nitro Plus fame, he packed that same 1,300 seat room, and he's not a voice actor or a musician. He's a writer.
He did not pack it.
You didn't? It looked pretty full when I was in there. Maybe it's because they were all in line to ask him questions.
It wasn't full, but I mean, from my point of view, it looked like 500 or 600 people. It looked like a very healthy crowd.
It was a decent crowd. I would put it closer to 200.
Wow.
I'm pretty bad at gauging a number of people, I guess, but yeah, it was definitely a lot more people than you would expect.
That is true.
For a guy who doesn't have like a song or is the voice of a character to, you know, be requested to say lines in or anything like that.
The worst is when you're at a panel for a guest, a very accomplished guest, and there's a Q&A session and a few questions are asked, and then they run out of people to ask questions. That's death.
I do feel like the questions have gotten better over the years. Like, I used to dread the Q&A with so-and-so panels because inevitably you got someone saying, I pirated this show and I didn't like the ending. Could you make a new one? I don't feel like we get those anymore.
Yeah, the Urobuchi Q&A was very interesting, not just because, there was this huge line of people.
Yeah, they were good questions.
Yeah, they were asking questions about his visual novels, about his different shows, like spanning his entire career. It was good stuff.
Like, I don't think with research I could have pulled together a better set of questions for those.
For sure. So, yeah, that was a high point, and I want more stuff like that happening, definitely.
Yeah.
From Ben the Bear, he asks, which Oniamis 2 Blue Uru do you wish had been made? Hiroyuki Yamaga's Streets of Fire tribute or the Anno one?
I'm not really cognizant of what the Anno one would entail. I've always wanted the Yamaga one.
Yeah, same here.
I typically am not the biggest Anno fan as it is in the first place, but you know, once you combine both Streets of Fire and Oneami's era Hiroyuki Yamaga, I'm like on board for that one.
Yeah, that just gives me a total nerd boner, just the idea of that.
Still waiting for the Streets of Fire Blu-ray.
Yeah, I got HD DVD still.
You should have told me. I made one ages ago.
Oh, I know you made one. I would like a real one, you know?
Well, am I not good enough for you?
No, you're good enough for me, Justin. I want one that I could buy people for Christmas and make them watch. That's what it's about.
All right. I did give you one, though, right?
You haven't, but we could make that happen.
I was considering saying, you know, the release of Streets of Fire on Blu-ray is going nowhere slowly, and it should be going nowhere fast, but I opted not
to. Oh, brutal.
Oh, we are such nerds.
It was kind of
super nerds.
There was a weird little 90s explosion, the 80s and 90s explosion on Blu-ray just in the last week. They put out, like, Clue, Adventures in Babysitting, Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion.
Oh, shit, yeah. That's out?
All at the same time, yeah. It's all out.
Those are all awesome movies.
Yeah. I love Romy and Michelle.
I haven't seen it forever, but I bought it.
Might be the gayest movie that I love.
What?
Okay. That's not true at all.
I was going to say, Justin. Seriously. Okay. Land of Obscusion asks, when Sam Panansky's anime streaming and funding site finally debuts, what titles would you love to see on it?
Vicky might end up fulfilling this. I haven't checked back recently, but I want to see properly translated versions of the Osamu Tezuka Love Can Save the World TV movies, like Marine Express and Bandar Book and Bremen 5 and all that stuff.
I don't have a better suggestion than those, actually.
No. I would like to finally see subtitled all of Goshogun.
Oh, that would be pretty great.
I don't anticipate that it's as good as I'm hoping it is, but it might be.
A few episodes have been fan-subbed, Justin. Have you seen them?
Yeah, but they're like episode 1 and 2, and it's not going to be good that early. It's just not. It's a long mecha show.
Yep.
Similar reasons why I don't know if Zabungle would be on the table. Because that's also one, along with the highly touted Giant Gorg. But I'm not sure if those would be in the running.
Yeah, Gorg I'd be down for. Zabungle, that was one of those shows that I would borrow from a friend a VHS tape in EP speed with like 8 episodes of it on there and just leave it running for an entire day while I screwed around doing other stuff. But I wouldn't mind seeing that again.
I'm going to go with Violinist of Hamelin.
Oh, I love that TV show to death. I actually, back in the day, I ran my own fan sub of it for personal use.
Wow, I know it by reputation, but I've never seen it.
Well, you know, obviously it's basically best remembered for having literally zero budget and for by and large is a series of stills. But, you know, as a huge fan of Yasuhiro Imagawa, Giant Robo fame, you know, he basically had a lot of freedom to do his own deal with that show. And it's fantastic.
I loved the opening, and I loved the Super Nintendo platformer.
Oh, the Super Nintendo platformer is certainly much more in keeping with the manga, as well as the, I guess it was a movie, you know, very Slayers-esque, very silly. And, of course, the manga eventually, you know, took a pretty serious turn as well. But, yeah, that TV show was definitely one I was big into in my teenage and college years.
Okay, going to go with Lika-chan.
I like Lika-chan, even though it's Japanese Barbie.
I was hoping I could find something where no one would be like, you know, that's actually pretty good.
Sorry. Look what this podcast is called, Zach.
I was going to say, I'm sorry, Zach. Almost anything you throw at me, my response is just going to be, yes, it must be preserved.
All right. Speaking of which, Land of Obscusion asks, for Mike, says he likes to call Gundam Musashi the anime equivalent of The Room, the film The Room, if you're familiar with that. Would you agree with that comparison?
I haven't seen The Room. I kind of know it by reputation. It doesn't seem very interesting to me.
In sort of like hilariously bad, watched a lot because it's hilariously bad, that kind of thing.
Well, I mean, I've seen several episodes of Gundam Musashi, and that's not really a thing that you can enjoy at a stretch exactly.
One episode is enough.
Yeah, I mean, it gets hard to watch very quickly, and that's why I think it works best as clips. I wouldn't want to sit through, like, you know, on 90 minutes of Gundo Musashi.
That said, there were enough people who wanted it and wanted the screwed up TV version that it did get a pretty limited release on DVD in Japan.
Yeah,
it has its followers.
It not only did it get a limited release, it was a bestseller, an ironic bestseller.
It sold out. It sold out. I think you can only get it used on Amazon for, you know, like 150% of its original retail price.
Okay.
But yeah.
But yeah, I don't think you know, Gundo Musashi is the person who created it is completely oblivious that the thing he created is bad, or is going to backpedal and say, "Oh yeah, I meant for Gundo Musashi to suck." I know when Monkey Punch came to America, this was right around when Gundo Musashi was airing, he kind of washed his hands of the whole affair because he saw, you know, what they were doing.
Fujiwara Nosai asks, Wile E. Coyote hires GoGo 13 to take out the Roadrunner. Can he do it?
Well, let's just interrupt the question right there and say it's fundamentally flawed because Wile E. Coyote could not hire GoGo 13 because one of GoGo 13's prerequisites for taking a job is it must be explained to him in full why his target deserves to die. And Wile E. Coyote is not particularly well known for his communication skills. There's maybe one episode of the Looney Tunes where he even talks, the super genius one. And, you know, wooden sign saying, shoot this guy, isn't enough for GoGo to accept the job. So,
I feel like if you could trick GoGo 13 into doing it, he would do it. Wile E. Coyote has never tried to hire a proxy killer to do. He always tries to do the job himself. Maybe that's why he fails.
I think that's what Wile E. Coyote wants, is he doesn't want someone else to catch the Roadrunner. It has to be him. It's like Zenigata catching Lupin.
Okay.
That was a silly question.
It's a trick question.
It was a silly
I can't be tricked.
All right. Wandering Waves asks, do you guys ever watch AMVs? And if so, what are some of your favorites?
I do not watch AMVs, and I'm actually kind of mystified that they're still as massively popular as they are, even to this day, considering how easy it is for people to make them. I guess it's still that much more difficult to be made well. But the whole AMV thing has eluded me, which is fascinating because every year I go to Anime Week in Atlanta, which is like the AMV mecca,
right.
Two seats.
The VAT track at AWA is practically a con unto itself at this point.
Operates in like one internally too, I think.
Yeah. As for AMVs, I don't watch them. I have friends who create them, and I'm sure it'll vex them a little bit to hear me tell it, but I've never been interested in AMVs at all. Honestly, I'd prefer to see that kind of creativity put to use making more original animation or other kind of fan generated content, but as a way to keep fans engaged and making their own stuff, they seem to work pretty well.
Yeah, I was really into them in the 90s when they were, you know, hard to make. And I made a handful myself, including my personal favorite, MD Geist 2, William Shatner's Mr. Tambourine Man.
Excellent.
Yeah, but once nonlinear editors started being common, it got too easy to slam together some clips to some music. It's just, like, I could probably make...
There's software that'll automatically do it.
Right. I could make an AMV, a fairly decent one, in less, probably about half the time it takes to play the song. So,
in fairness, a lot of the high level AMVs I've seen in recent years will do some pretty crazy stuff. Like, they'll use separate painting effects and Photoshop effects to try and create different moods. There's stuff that will use snatches of dialogue and run it through auto-tune to match it up to the song.
Oh, right. And if we're talking about that, what we're really talking about is motion graphics type stuff. But that's really a very, very small subsection of AMVs. And there's only a handful of people that can pull that off. Those people, sure, go nuts. That stuff is cool. I will happily sit through that. But the vast majority of AMVs is this horrible wasteland of sloppily slammed together YouTube rips of fan subs. And they all make me want to cut my eyes out and just kind of pop them like a zit.
I will say this. The best ever anime music video is the one that Mega64 created. Yeah, Zach knows it.
Yeah.
Right over my head.
Well, people will look it up.
I'm pretty sure it's on YouTube. It's something they made for a gag reel for their Anime Expo panel a few years ago. Pretty funny stuff.
I would like to see the U.S. crowd sort of adopt that more Nico Nico style MAD approach of, you know, either redoing openings with certain characters or making original animations or even like recording your own song and then doing a little animation like that. I think that's sort of an area where the Japanese fandom is, I don't want to say ahead of the curve, but just on a different wavelength.
Oh, absolutely. Well, they can draw better. But
I've long argued that anime music videos are popular because they're fun, but personally I find them to be creatively bankrupt. There's nothing in there that's particularly creative. Like, you're not really creating anything. You're just sort of smashing two things together. And a lot of times it feels like these people are making these just to get a reaction out of the audience, so...
And yeah, you can see that there are some that are edited in such a way that you can tell that it was created with that squee from a live audience in mind, pan up to the popular character.
Yeah, they're pausing for laughs.
Hold.
Pausing for laughs, which is really just like, are you kidding me? And they're not interesting. Like, to me, it's a bunch of clips of something that smashed up against a song. It's whatever. Like, I appreciate that people enjoy making them. I appreciate that people really like watching them. It's a fun thing to do at a convention. But don't ask me to take it seriously, like, as a creative thing, because it's not.
Yeah, more often than not, they're teenagers experimenting with how music can change the mood of a scene. And as a film guy, I think that's great that they're exploring that. Just don't make me watch that.
Here's what I want to see. I want to see people doing stuff like Pogo. I want to see that. I want to see.
Oh, my goodness. That would be incredible.
I want to see somebody taking clips and sounds from a TV show and making a mashup song out of it, where you're creating music from pieces of little bits of sound from the show that you love. And then, like, that would be great. Like, I would sit there and watch people attempting to do what Pogo does all day long.
The next generation Negative Land.
Yeah, sure.
Totally, totally. That's a great analogy, actually.
Yeah. Okay. Wandering Waves asks, recently, anime series have been making movies that are just rehashes of the series. I don't think that's a recent thing.
That's not recent.
That's been since Mobile Suit Gundam days, but yeah.
Any reason for this?
Older.
Any reason for this besides a cash?
Yamato.
Well, let me finish. Did we get the question there?
did you say any reason for this besides a cash grab?
Yes,
is that the whole question?
Yes, that's the question.
Yeah, cash grab. But also, I mean, there are maybe, like, I can count on maybe one hand the amount of times where it's sort of a valid mulligan. It's usually only in cases where the TV show has a lot of dead air that would be benefited from trimming down. But most of the time when they decide to do that, the end result is you just get a story that's entirely too rushed for its running time and doesn't really have time to breathe.
Yeah, I mean, I think those happen just because they're relatively low risk products. You know, they're generally based on something that's already popular, and so you got to cash in while you can, right? I mean, I'm hoping that in upcoming cases like the Tiger and Bunny movie that's coming out, that's going to be a lot of stuff from TV with new narration and some new footage. As long as they take it to a new place, it'll be worthwhile. But
yeah, I will say that the latest movies that I saw where I actually thought they pulled that concept off incredibly well was the Macross Frontier movies. You know, the first movie was seemingly like retelling, reinterpretation of the show, actually used some of the show's footage. And but they took it a different direction, and then the second movie was just a completely new ball game. And the Eva movies are sort of in that same respect, too. But I'm not sure if that's quite the same as what's being asked.
Yeah, I mean, it is just a cash grab. Creatively, like, that's kind of what it is. It's the same as what Hollywood does, which is
It's no different than the Bourne Legacy.
Yeah, no, it's really not. Except the Bourne Legacy is all new footage, new actors. Someone directed that. Like, it's a completely different film from the others.
Still creatively bankrupt.
It's still creatively bankrupt, but. a lot of this stuff, like the rehash movies where they're just using TV footage, that stuff, like, I wonder what the point is. I really, like, I wouldn't go see, like, hey, we're making a Parks and Rec movie, and it's all footage from the second season sort of awkwardly mashed into a single narrative. I wouldn't go see that. But I, you know, the stuff where they're just rehashing TV footage, that stuff I really don't get.
Where, I mean, years ago I could see them serving a purpose where, you know, it was a really long plot and it wasn't available easily on VHS and you'd have to, you know, try to catch up or something. That I could see it serving utility, but not in the last 15, 20 years.
Those Gurren Lagann movies felt particularly pointless. Anyway.
I didn't bother with them.
Yeah, I didn't watch them at all.
I didn't watch the show, so I watched the movies.
Oh.
And the and it did not do a good job.
I think then the movies are probably then an example of what I was talking about, where there isn't really much to excise from the original source material, so once it comes time to get it down to movie time slot, something's got to go that doesn't really deserve to be taken out.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see here. Okay. I think this might be our last question. Oh, nope, that's not true. Okay, BrackusJS asks, manliest drink while watching Man-Ime? Hard liquor, mixers, beer, what's your stiff one of choice?
I do not drink alcohol.
Yeah. Daryl's high on life.
I'm high on cartoons.
I used to love a good Manhattan, but I pretty much stopped drinking, too.
I enjoy drinking beer. I don't drink a lot of hard liquor at all. My current beer brand of choice is a Scottish brew called Innocent Gun. Very tasty.
What did you drink when rewatching Gundam Wing?
I was drinking Innocent Gun. I was drinking that, and I was drinking. There's a local liquor store chain called Cappy's. I was drinking Cappy's store brand bourbon.
Wow. I would feel like if.
You needed the hard stuff, man.
I would feel like
Gundam Wing.
If you're gonna sit there and watch, you know, Golgo 13 the Professional, you need to have a little tumbler of scotch, either straight or with a couple ice cubes in it. And yeah.
That's actually Golgo 13's anesthetic for surgery of choice. Because, you know, you won't let people put him under.
And then when you're
done, I figured Zach, you'd say it would be a martini of some sort. Aren't you always martini time?
For me personally, like, I don't drink while I'm watching anime, because if I'm watching anime, that means I need to be paying attention to it, and it's too easy for me to drift off into not paying attention while I'm drinking, so I don't really drink while I'm watching anime.
Kids, don't drink and watch anime.
I prefer to watch things subtitled. It means that the thing I'm watching deserves my full attention.
Do drink and watch anime. Don't do it when you're being paid to then talk about it or write about it in a meaningful and substantial manner afterward. Like, that's, you don't want to do that.
A message to the three of us.
Yeah. my stiff drink of choice is changed, and now I am just a vodka rocks guy. But I don't drink that much anymore either, because I'm getting old. And your body can't really take it anymore after a certain period of time.
Yeah. 30s are like that.
Yeah. Although people would hear me say that and go, like, you're 32. Shut the fuck up.
Right.
Shut the fuck up. You're not getting old.
I drink way more now than I did in my 20s. I still don't drink very much, but, you know.
Well, anyway. All right. John DCP asks, any ideas for how dokes, Mike, this is your terminology, you coined this. This is the new,
very proud of it,
the new phrase that we were all using to mention Madoka Magica, just the dokes.
Just call it dokes.
The dokes. I like the dokes. I like the dokes. Dokes.
That's good too.
Not just dokes, the dokes.
How are the dokes doing? Yeah. Wants to know how it's doing financially for Aniplex USA. There sure seem to be a lot of limited editions left to buy. I'm pretty sure that got reprinted. Maybe?
It has to be. That's like the hottest show, you know, around.
I'll bet the regular singles did pretty well, but I'll bet the LEs just sat there.
You think so?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are people actually buying it? I mean, remember, there are also legal streaming options for Madoka Magica. They rolled it out in stages on Crunchyroll. I don't know, man. All I know is that the Manga UK set coming out in October for about $50, that looks awfully tempting to me. As to whether or not I grab that over the Aniplex ones, time will tell.
I don't know. I'm happy to have the limited editions that I have. That is a show I will be rewatching at some point in the future, and I'm glad to have those sets. Okay. Let's see here. Chuo Dori asks, was Funimation licensing Yamato Resurrection a contractual condition in getting the rights for Yamato 2199? Maybe that's.
I don't think so. I think they're sort of testing the waters. I mean, the first thing I asked.
Do they have the rights to 2199?
No, they haven't announced that.
No, they don't. No, they don't.
Then why is this person asking that question?
I think they're trying to see what their motivation was for licensing Resurrection in the first place, and I can only speculate that, well, it's one movie and you're done in one, and if that is received well, then maybe they would consider taking the gamble on 2199, which is multiple films or episodes, as the case may be. Although the thing is that I always thought was a little puzzling is that Yamato Resurrection is 100% old school nostalgia cash grab, like, you know, the niche's final, you know, hurrah. Whereas 2199 is the reboot for the new age. And if there are still people who want Yamato, do they want it as Space Battleship Yamato or do they want it as Star Blazers? These are Tim Eldred questions.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
not really.
Yeah, really.
the big question for me when I heard that Resurrection had gotten picked up by Funimation was that, okay, they're going to dub it. So the question becomes, do they recast or do they dig up all of the old Star Blazers actors? Because they're all still out there, man.
I kind of feel that they should probably go that route and do a Star Blazers one, because it's like when ADV re-released, you know, Macross or Gatchaman. The people who want to hear that show in English want to hear the version that they heard as kids or a version that's evocative of that. So that means if people want to see Macross in English, they want the Robotech version. Hacked up though it may be, people who want to see Gatchaman in English want Battle of the Planets with Casey Kasem.
I
thought that Gatchaman dub was brilliant. That ADV.
Yeah, me
did.
Too. Me
I'm
too.
Just saying that wasn't what people wanted. I mean, I thought they really knocked it out of the park. But I mean, I'm sure Funimation, their core guys would do a fine job. But I just, if I'm gonna watch that show in English, I want, you know, Amy Howard Wilson and crew. You know, even though their voices are probably, you know, totally different from what they were in the 70s.
Well, the thing is, the characters are older in Resurrection too, so you could totally do that.
Spin it that way.
Yeah,
but yeah, I don't think it's a contractual like, oh, we won't give you $21.99 unless you take this one first, because as far as I can tell, you know, I can't tell. What am I going to say? I was going to say
this is all speculation. We don't know anything about this.
I don't want to go too far because
that's why I don't even want to say too much. You know. It's just like that's a really odd question and kind of a leading question. And no, as far as I'm concerned, I think they just picked it up to kind of see if, I mean, it's a decent movie. And if it sells well, maybe it'll lead someplace good for Yamato fans.
Okay. From Ed Sizemore. Is it true when Miyazaki dies, anime dies with him?
No, it's when Miyazaki dies, Studio Ghibli dies with him.
Yeah, I think that in its current incarnation, yes. I think that that's probably true.
I think the whole studio is set up to be this autocracy that, you know, you do what Miyazaki says or you hit the road. You know, Isao Takahata will allegedly release a new movie after a 12-plus year hiatus, but I'll believe it when I see it. The master has no heirs apparent. Much as they want Gorō Miyazaki to be the man.
Yeah. I feel bad. I feel bad for that guy.
Yeah.
I mean, where did the statement, when I die, anime dies with me, come from? Because Ed's brought that up a couple of times, and it's just like, that's a terribly egotistical thing to say.
I don't know if Miyazaki himself would say that. I mean, I've poured through Starting Point, which is, you know, I know you guys have that book, and it's great for Miyazaki's take on, you know, this is the real Lupin, guys. You know, the rest of you suck. But, you know, that's kind of Miyazaki's worldview. Everybody sucks but me. So maybe he could have said, when I die, anime dies with me. But I'm sure, you know, if you were to give an interview now, you would have said anime died long ago and I'm the only one keeping it real.
Well, he didn't present it as a quote. I think it's just a general idea.
It's just something that he thinks, maybe.
Yeah, it's a general idea.
Yeah, I mean, if the rest of the anime industry were following Studio Ghibli's lead, maybe he would be onto something. But basically, there's what Studio Ghibli's doing, and then there's what everybody else is doing.
Yeah. Now, what Studio Ghibli is now will die with Miyazaki. What it becomes after that, because it makes way too much money for them to just let it die and not try and continue it, no one knows.
Right. I mean, they could go the, you know, Porco Rosso 2, you know, direct to video route, or they could, you know, start giving a lot of other people a shot who just never got to see again. Because, hey, the few efforts that they did from new guys, most of those were, hey, pretty impressive. And then what was their next work? Oh, nothing.
Is Miyazaki's in his 70s?
Oh, yeah. He's, you know, if Takahata's pushing 80, then yeah, Miyazaki can't be that far behind either.
So he's probably got another 10 years left in him. Ugh.
Doesn't he smoke a lot? I mean,
man. No, yeah. I just hear that and it's just like 10 years. So think about, you know, 8 to 9 years from now, what his last movie is actually going to be like.
Well, that's going to be coherent.
They already don't make a lot of sense.
Oh, I enjoyed Ponyo because, I mean, it was a heartwarming children's movie and he got to destroy civilization. He got to have his cake and eat it.
Yeah, it's just that narratively, he's so far gone at this point. Like, he used to tell coherent stories.
It won't be like as huge a tragedy when Miyazaki passes away as it was when, say, Satoshi Kon did, because we can kind of see that Miyazaki's best work has already come. I don't think he's got like another like thing that'll just blow us away in the tank. I mean, I could be wrong. Well, but
that, and no one seems to actually like him personally.
He's also enshrined as a god already. Like, he's a living legend. And everyone treats him like that, and he seems to have this creative stranglehold on Studio Ghibli, where they just can't do anything that he doesn't want them to do. And I kind of want to see
or the
what
way
the
he
other,
wants them to do it.
And I kind of want to see what those people have in them creatively that is not being strangled by Miyazaki. I'm not looking forward to the guy's death, but I feel like you're looking at a golden idol and saying like, okay, well, I'm kind of looking forward to this not being the chief influence on this studio anymore, like, which I feel will only happen when he's dead. Like,
right. I think the only person right now who routinely will criticize Miyazaki, you know, in public is Mamoru Oshii.
Yeah. Well, that was Ed's next question, is Miyazaki versus Oshii in a knife fight. Who wins?
I think I actually have a friend or an acquaintance who actually made a sort of a doujinshi, as it were, that was all about Miyazaki and Oshii meeting up for a duel to the death. It was a pretty funny comic.
Well,
I don't remember because I don't have the comic in front of me, but I just remember there was a lot of them murdering each other. It was probably a very samurai movie-esque, they both kill each other simultaneously, for all I know. I can't remember what Oshii's Hilsy did.
Oshii's a lot younger, but he's not powered by hate.
Yeah, he's perennially bored. I mean, anytime footage of Oshii, he looks like he's about to fall asleep.
I picture Miyazaki as the aggressor, you know, pulling out the knife, and I picture Oshii intercepting it, turning the blade on Miyazaki, but Miyazaki, in his hatred, even in his death throes, lifting Oshii up and then throwing him off the cliff.
See, to me, this is like that scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark, when the dude pulls the sword out and does all these crazy sword tricks.
Indy is just very, nonplussed.
Yes, and just...
And calmly pulls out a pistol.
Yes, of course. And that, I think in this scenario, Indiana Jones is Mamoru Oshii. I would posit that. Clippia asks, what's your general opinion of the works of Akiyuki Shinbo? Is he the best working TV director right now?
I'm actually not a fan of Shinbo, and if I see his name attached to a project, of which there are several, it's usually a disinclination for me. But, I mean, he did do Madoka, and so, you know, there are... isn't like completely mud in my mind, but I don't know if he's the best director working right now, and who is kind of a difficult call for me to make.
I think the best director working now is Shinichiro Watanabe. You know,
right?
I think Shinbo is possibly the most versatile.
Yeah, he's the most prolific.
Yeah, well, he did. He's done stuff like Madoka Magica. He did the Soul Taker, and on the other hand, he's like the man behind Hidamari Sketch. Like, that's his baby.
Yeah, very unpredictable. I can never tell if I'll like his stuff or not. I do think that he has a tendency to be very visually ham-fisted. Like, there is very little in the way of filmic subtlety to anything he does. Everything is very bang you over the head, look at this very forced angle, look at this violent contrasting shot. You know, it's very, lyrically, it's kind of a, you know, all over the place. But
very sensory overload.
Exactly. But that suits some things, and it way doesn't suit others. And when he hits hard.
Yeah.
I'm okay with him. I kind of wish that there are other people working, like Watanabe, like Sayo Yamamoto, that I wish could get more work. But Shinbo's good at what he does.
Yeah. I still like Tsuneo Kobayashi, if we forget about Kurokami.
Tsuneo Kobayashi is the showrunner, not the chief director, but the showrunner for Polar Bear Cafe. So he's doing good work.
There you go.
Okay, this is important. GAVV asks, he's heading to Vegas this weekend, and he asks the super nerds, red or black?
Ooh, the ultimate game show. The ultimate computer science tree. I'm going to say, as Wesley Snipes said in Passenger 57, always bet on black.
You stole my quote. That's exactly what I was going to say.
I'm going to go with black, too. My number is black 17. I have won 6 times on black 17. Okay. The Ferrix asks, maybe the longest Twitter time in history. What do you see happening to fandom if fans can no longer purchase their favorite anime?
Nothing. I mean, this fandom is built on theft.
Are we already doing that?
Also, you know, I hate to say it, but aren't we already there?
Yeah, that's what I just
said. Yeah, we've been there for 5 years.
Same as it always was. Okay, Chuodori, what are your thoughts, if any, on Danny Chu? Is he exploiting enemy fans for his own benefit, or is he just someone proven that any goal is possible if you work hard enough for it? Having a famous dad, yada, yada, yada.
I'm not a fan of Danny Chu or the message he advances and the agenda that he, the image that he sells, but he's really, really good at persuading people to believe a dream that they want to believe is true. I ultimately think that he's something of a charlatan, but I guess he's got a huge following, and it does help that his daddy is a multimillionaire. So it's the dream of just go to Japan and have a stormtrooper outfit and dance around and people will love you and you can make a career. Maybe that part isn't entirely on the up and up.
I've heard he doesn't take any money from his dad.
Well, I mean, he's smart. He's smart enough. I mean, he's worked. He knows IT. He knows that tech really well.
Dude works really hard. And, you know,
he knows marketing.
I've had a few conversations. I've had a few conversations with him, and I do like him as a person. I don't get what he does or the appeal of it, but I will just kind of shrug and walk away. I'm just like,
you know, in the first Pat Labor movie, the villain H.E. Hoba, there was like no record of him existing.
Right.
The fascinating thing about Danny Chu is that he's so good at the tech side of things that if you try to search information on him, the only thing you'll find is stuff that he's written.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, he's really good at quote, covering his tracks. You know, the guy has no online footprint besides what he's put out.
I'm not really interested in what he does. Like, the whole angle he takes towards anime culture and otaku culture, that's something that fundamentally I'm just not interested in at all.
Yeah, I'm not interested in it either, and I'm actually kind of opposed to it. But, you know, he's got it figured out.
All I really know about him is that his blog is kind of ugly and cluttered, and there's a really mean Colony Drop article about him.
Well, and he's really glad that there's going to be Hobbit movies, because that means his Gollum impersonation is relevant again.
Yeah, he's got to get a new opener.
Yeah. He closed with that, I think, at the opening ceremonies. Like, that was his go-to thing.
You know, he did that at the business conference in Singapore that I hosted.
I know, you mentioned that, and that's why.
Holy shit.
Yeah. It was so weird and not really appropriate for that crowd, but it did wake people up, so I can't really fault him entirely.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't have a huge problem with Danny Chu, except the fact that, you know, I feel like he is most effective, and this is probably his goal. He's best at promoting Danny Chu, and not a lot else. That's what he does, and that's fine. Like, a lot of people make their nut that way. Like, that's totally cool. Whether or not I take him seriously as like somebody who's seriously interested in promoting the art of Japanese animation, maybe not. But you know, whatever. Again, like, I don't really...
He's really good at convincing people to do work for free.
Yeah.
But I mean, aside from contributing photographs for the cosplay books that he did, what work is this? Like, I know there was something
about... Didn't he want people to do animation for the show he was pitching?
But that was like 3 years ago, and nothing has happened. So I'm not worried about that.
I think also model designs and all kinds of stuff like that. I mean, he's real good at the, you know, do this and get publicity or exposure in the industry, you know, that kind of thing, and people go for it.
Well, if that are they going for it? Because it doesn't sound like any of those have really gained much
traction. None of them
traction.
Have actually come off the ground, so, you know, hopefully not enough people are going for it.
Yeah, again, like, I guess
the attempt is being made repeatedly. I guess
I look at him and I see, like, oh, you're really good at promoting yourself and you're making money doing that. So, great. Good for you. That's the only reaction I can have. Like, I'm not going to begrudge him his success, but I'm also not going to sit here and say, like, oh, he's really great for anime fandom and he's totally helping the industry. No, he's helping himself, and that's fine. That's how people make money.
And if anything, if it all goes belly up, he knows that he's at least got a good roof over his head, okay. One way or another.
All right, we're down to our last two questions.
Oh,
last
baby.
Two. Zump1 asks, how would you explain the rise in G Gundam's popularity and the drop in Gundam Wing's popularity?
I would say that Gundam Wing has sort of become obsolete over years because there's been similar shows like it that have continued to get made with higher budgets, with, you know, more contemporary music and designs.
Yeah, put Gundam Wing next to Code Geass, you know?
Yeah, and it's like you don't really need Gundam Wing anymore, whereas G Gundam is still kind of a novelty. There hasn't really been a series quite like it. You know, certainly there have been other super robot shows, but the similarities more or less end there. And I think as more people have gotten to see the show and rediscover it, they've just developed an appreciation for it that maybe wasn't there at first, especially among the hardcore, like, this isn't the real Gundam sort of crowd. It's sort of moved beyond that at this
point. Well, half the reason people even like Gundam Wing was for the Bishonen. Those designs are ugly today.
Yeah, the designs don't correspond to the designs as they appear in promotional art and the art books and that sort of thing. Which, you know, it's the Weiss-Croix syndrome all over again.
Right.
The
cheap
TV
animation
show
just
is pretty cheap.
Like,
and, you know, the promo and the art books and stuff, that's kind of the idea that people have in their mind. But, yeah, I just think that, you know, Gundam Wing is, there's little need to revisit it now that you've got a slew of other shows that scratch the same itch.
Yeah, I will say that the Gundam, you know, Shin Sasaki and the Gundam Committee folks that I talked to at Otakon were very surprised to learn that G Gundam was as popular as it is.
I heard that they were saying that, you know, there's women can't like Gundam shows because they have robots in action, but I think that's just to save face among the Fujoshi crowd who, you know, the whole appeal of that game is you're not supposed to be doing this. So I think that's, they can't possibly not know, especially with some of the art book layouts and choices that they've got rolling out there for their work. But yeah, I mean, yeah. G Gundam, it's, you know, it's a wild, you know, fun show in an era where a lot of shows have been, you know, deadly serious. It did air on the Cartoon Network, and that was people's childhood. If you think about it, how much time has passed between that Toonami era and now. That's now the thing they grew up with watching as a kid. It's their Transformers. So I think that's it.
Yeah, and I'm just wishing that I had, you know, sat down with those guys and tried to explain them the image meme of you've seen the one from Futurama of Fry saying shut up and take my money.
Oh,
have you seen the G Gundam variant that someone made where he's holding up the wad of cash, but it's Fry dressed up as Domon Kashu saying shut up and take my love, my anger, and all of my money.
I appreciate the joke.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting, and it's very hard to explain, but it's a good joke.
I had to make "shut up and take my money" a bannable offense on the forums.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was a catchphrase.
No, it's it's starting to ebb now, but for a while there, it seemed like I would see that every day on Facebook.
Yeah.
Maybe in response to every Discotech announcement. It's like, yeah,
I was going to say, Daryl, if you go to Discotech's Facebook page, you'll see like at least 5 instances of it in every one of their new releases.
Okay. Just set up a subscription at this point.
Oh, I'd be down, man. If they wanted to do that, I'd do it. Throw that out there.
If they, you know, free idea for Discotech. Start the Discotech Anime Club. Start it out. You pay a certain amount, you get out all of their releases for a year or 2 years or whatever it is, however long you sign up. Make it like the old Columbia Music Club.
Yeah.
Just do it. You will get a whole bunch of old dudes like us subscribing to it and just super excited to see what it is you're going to come out with next.
Like you'll probably get like 800 to 1,000 people, which for a service like that, that's plenty.
Yeah.
That is really a really cool idea, actually.
Free to you, provided free of any fee or anything like that. There's my consulting. There you go, Discotech. Do that. Okay. This is our final question. You guys, we are done. Almost done. Cecil234 asks, why the hell are anime fans so damn hard to please?
Well, it's because...
Oh, my God.
There's a million reasons for that. I mean, the fundamental reason is that they're much younger than a lot of other organized internet fandoms. And so there's an adolescent sense of, could say entitlement going on there. But, yeah, I mean, wow, that's a topic that would take its own show.
It's pretty different. It's pretty. I think it's because they all want different things. So you can never release something that is exactly how everyone wants it, ever.
Some people want honorifics on everything. Some people want an actual translation.
Some people will actually complain if there's a dub. These people exist.
Yeah, I mean, I just got into it a bit with a guy who was mad that Discotech does not put honorifics on their subtitle tracks. And, you know, that to me, I was like, that's completely ridiculous. And, you know, they were incensed. But, I mean, you know, there's basically nothing that can be done to quell the eternal fan rage, as it were.
Everyone's very passionate, and you know, passion drives anger.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind having incredibly high standards. That's cool. It does bum me out a little when people will basically pick a commercial release apart, looking for some issue that they can hold up and say, "Well, I guess I'll just pirate it," since they didn't get it exactly right.
Yeah, it's annoying. I would say that, like...
I mean, I came into anime fandom kind of concurrently with getting into Hong Kong movies in the early 90s, and just, like, the quality of translation and localization on anime is so high.
Exponential. It's even
exponentially,
to this day.
Exponentially higher than how other foreign film is treated. Like, way higher, way higher.
Well, and, it was, anyway.
There's only a couple of like prestigious Hong Kong outlets.
I was gonna
go Dragon Dynasty, and the rest
say,
is just quagmire.
Yeah, if it's Dragon Dynasty, yeah, it's getting the royal treatment. But short of that, you never know. You could get some pretty crazy stuff going on.
Yeah, you're right. I'm comparing Criterion to like Crunchyroll. That's clearly not fair.
I would say that like just like any other fan base. It seems to me that the internet has made it so that if you're a fan of something, the chief thing that you do online, not for me, not for anyone here, but just the thing that I've noticed is that if you're a fan of something, most of your time is spent complaining about it. And
or
so,
finding an echo chamber of people who line up with your opinions and reinforce them.
Yes, exactly.
I've, I've noticed that in your Twitter remarks on the forum, Zach. It seems like there's just this sharp ramping up of people that are just upset. Not even that they feel like reviews or editorial remarks on stuff is wrong, just that it disagrees with their opinion.
Yeah, which really is upsetting, because it tells me that, like, here's a bunch of people who aren't thinking critically and aren't confident enough in their own opinions, and so they see, like, your negative opinion of something or your... Not even negative. Your opinion of anything is just not good enough for them because it's not theirs exactly, and they do want it parroted back to them word for word. Like, it's not... You have to use the exact same words that they would have used in order for them to be satisfied, and...
I mean, maybe it's the old guy in me talking, but, you know, if someone came to me and said, oh, you're a big fan of that Lock the Superman movie, well, that's a piece of crap because X, Y, and Z, my first thought would actually be, awesome, you watched that movie.
Yeah, and now you have someone to talk to about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's the thing. To me, like, reviews in this modern age are the jumping-off point for discussion, and that's the best thing you can possibly do about art is discuss it.
Yeah,
and not just try and force it so that your opinion is the only one that's being represented. And it feels like a lot of these forum guys, like, that is ultimately what they want. They want their opinion.
I think that they feel that's what discussion is the art of trying to force other people to see that your viewpoint is right. And if someone else responds to you, your response is to restate what you said.
Yeah, that's... Wow. I mean, that fucking sucks, but it's probably true. That's awful. But
well, there are people capable of critical thought and people who are not, and unfortunately, there's no easy way to separate the two.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
All I can say is people, you know, there are folks out there who think Citizen Kane was a piece of shit. And you know what? That's fine. Don't even worry about it.
But here's the thing, though. I want that guy who thinks that Citizen Kane is a piece of shit
to tell you why.
To tell me why. Like, I'm fascinated by that. Please tell me why it's a piece of shit. I really want to know. I want to know why you think that. And you know, it sounds condescending. But no, I just want to have the discussion. Like, I just want to talk. Like, that's all there is to it. So, yeah, I don't know. We'll see how it goes, you know, this year and beyond. But I have noticed that is becoming increasingly the thing where it's very
well,
much...
Look on a bigger scale too, like the fact that there was a legitimate scandal with people who gave negative reviews to the new Batman movie getting death threats.
Anyone had seen the film.
Yeah, that kind of thing didn't happen a couple of years ago. That's new.
Yeah, well, Batman.
I just think it's the internet does this to people. The way that the internet is structured, the way that we're consuming media, it lends itself to you becoming this way. And that's why I figure it's like a topic that could, you know, span its own show virtually.
Yeah. Well, at any rate, I don't think anime fans are impossible to please. I think it's as diverse and outspoken a fan base as really anything else. I don't feel, and I've never felt this way, that anime fandom is worse than really any other kind of fandom. It is just kind of its own thing, and we see these behaviors across all kinds of different things.
I will say, as a guy that has worked in the anime industry forever, that when I step outside of that circle and produce anything non-anime, I feel that the bar for every other media is so much lower quality-wise that I can get away with almost anything.
Well, then, you know, at least the fans are keeping them honest, right?
Right. I agree. I mean... Before, look at how fans have evolved making DVDs, and you know, there have been very good things that have come out of it. So,
I mean, I think there's definitely truth to the idea that anime fans, as a group, in some ways, are very hard to please. But you know what? I just want us all to hang out and watch anime and have fun with it.
Well, that would be the ideal, and hopefully, you know, we'll get there at some point. But that wraps us up. We are finished.
Wow.
That was a 3-hour show.
Cool.
Thank you, guys.
You know, I have dinner reservations in 45 minutes. I didn't think I would have to rush for it.
Okay, well, All right, well, we're done here. Big thanks to you guys for showing on up. Always a huge pleasure to have you on.
Well, wait a minute. Can we go another hour? I want to talk about Free Jack.
Mick Jagger's finest.
Next time. God. Next time for sure.
All right. That's our Super Nerds episode. Thank you guys so much for showing up.
It was our pleasure. Thanks.
Likewise.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Mike and Daryl for showing on up. Theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at thenewdivision.net. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a rating or review. We would really appreciate that. And we will see you all next week.